welcome to episode 272 of the Samuel Emanuel Movie Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Sam Reimer.
And I'm Manny Manuel.
Happy Palm Springs Day to you, Manny.
Happy Palm Springs Day to you, my good friend.
It is not quite yet Palm Springs Day. It's November 2nd, 2023.
Mm-hmm.
But coming up is November 9th, which I imagine will probably be the day you put this out.
No.
No, you're going to put it out a little earlier?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, if you're listening to this and you're listening to it right when it came out, you still have a little bit of time to get your Palm Springs watch in before the official day. But this is one that I think we talked about doing last year. I think maybe like November, like mid-November, we were like, oh, you know what we really should have done? And we just missed it. Or maybe as we were approaching the day, we had already scheduled something this week, but we're like, next year we got to do it. So this is one that's been in the works for a little bit. Palm Springs Day, a movie that Manny and I have talked about doing for some time, and we're very excited to do, and we will get into it in short order. What is it you're looking for there, Manny?
I was just seeing what we were recording around the same time last year.
Any results?
Yeah. So the week before would have been Remembrance Day. We did Dunkirk.
Mm-hmm.
And the week of, so we would have recorded the day after Palm Springs Day. We did Bugsy.
Ooh. That was a year ago?
Yeah.
I would have rather done Palm Springs. Would have rather done that, unfortunately.
At least we got a lovely Annette Bening.
We did. That was about all that we got.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately. Mm. Manny, take us through. What are we doing today?
Well, we are going to review Palm Springs in honor of Palm Springs Day, but before we get into that, we have some other stuff we want to cover, including a response from one of the people that nominated our Halloween horror episode, Interview with the Vampire, Garrett Nadeau. We were, if you remember, on air, we were a little confused as to why, spoiler alert, if you haven't already watched Interview with the Vampire. We were a little confused as to why it was so bad for Lestat to drink dead blood.
Ah, okay.
And Garrett was happy to respond.
I love it. Let's hear it.
Here it is. End quote. Hey, listen to your podcast, and when it comes to the feeding and the box scene, if you read the books, Anne Rice comments on this anyway, if a vampire feeds on humans and alive blood, they stay young and beautiful. If they do not, they will be reduced to basically a withered husk, sort of like what Lestat looks like after the attempted murder, and they will go literally insane, but will never actually die the real death. So vampires in Anne Rice canon do not have to drink human blood, but if they want the powerful, glamorous lifestyle, they do. He's also talking about, remember how we wondered, would Brad Pitt die if he was locked up in that box?
Yes.
So he would just kind of wither into a disgusting looking thing, but he would not die, according to the book. So it's covered in the book, but if they covered it in the film, it definitely slipped past us.
Yeah. Yeah. And while I'm sure that is all true, and I thank you to Garrett for getting back to us with that information. This always kind of comes back with book adaptations for us. There's always some answer in a book adaptation where we say, how come this wasn't talked about? And then some fan of the book says, well, if you read the book, yada, 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 yada. And I'm sure that is the case. And I thank Garrett for pointing it out, but I will also just say in retort that not everybody reads the books.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not to Garrett, this is more to Anne Rice or whoever the director of that film was, I forget.
Neil Jordan, who did Crying Game.
Yeah. If you want to include something in the movie that is explained in the books, you need to explain it in the movie as well. Mm-hmm. If you want to include that thing in the movie, in this case, the thing is having a withered husk of a Tom Cruise or having Brad Pitt potentially buried alive. I think you do need to explain what would happen for the audience who did not read the books. Mm. The book and the movie is a separate entity. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure others will feel differently.
I'm very thankful that Garrett gave us the answers that we were both looking for. But I agree. I wish the filmmakers had put the answers in the film as well.
Yeah, it's got to exist as its own standalone piece of art.
Agreed. I don't think that you should have to have required reading prior to watching a film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
you can have required watching if it's the MCU. Yeah. But
almost any trilogy.
Yeah.
Like, it's required watching to watch
Return of the King. If it's part of the same story, yeah.
It's required watching to watch Return of the King.
Yeah, for sure.
Is it required it must be required watching for, you can't, like, pick up Harry Potter, like, Goblet of Fire, could you?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, because then by the time you get to Deathly Hallows, who's this fucking house elf who's apparating all over the place?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of stuff.
Okay. Do you know, I've basically erased those movies from my memory.
And the whole idea of, like, I think number four is the first time, or Goblet of Fire is the first time we get Ralph Fiennes. It's the first time we get Ralph Fiennes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I feel like that is less of a big deal if you don't watch the first three first.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I wonder if I'll ever watch those again.
I'm sure you probably will. One day.
I'm sure my curiosity will be, it'll be like The English Patient. Are they as bad as I remember?
Yeah. If you watched the Fast and the Furious franchise once, you can handle Harry Potter twice. I think.
I've got one more Fast and Furious movie to watch.
God. Your completionism is admirable and a little stupid. A strange combination.
Speaking of stupid, we have to move on to a stupid but important part. The in memoriam.
Yeah.
It is stupid that we lose people, but that such is life.
Well, and, such is death.
And so true. We lost, while not a massive contributor to film, a massive, massive contributor to pop culture, we lost Matthew Perry this past week. I'm sure everybody knows him as Chandler Bing from Friends. He had a couple other roles in a couple of movies that we'll talk about, but sadly, he passed away. At this point in time, we don't have answers as to what exactly happened. It appeared he drowned in his jacuzzi for reasons unknown.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I saw recently is that no illegal narcotics were found in his home or his system. So, like, no fentanyl and no meth found anywhere. So it wasn't like an OD or something like that. So it appears that the cause of quite a few deaths, meth and fentanyl recently, are not the cause of Matthew Perry's demise at the moment. So we'll see. It came as a shock. And he didn't even hit 60 yet, I think, if I remember correctly.
54. 54.
Brr, that's dangerously close to my age.
Yeah, it's pretty darn young.
Before we talk about his big role, you have a movie that you did see him in.
Yeah, I'd be lying if I said it was one that I remembered him for particularly.
Mm-hmm.
I did see him in the, I should have pulled up the year already, 2009. From his Wikipedia page, it actually looks like it was his final film role, which is surprising that he didn't have any work from 2009 and beyond. But
I think he's dealing with some demons.
Yeah, he was indeed. 17 again. I watched. Don't remember a lot about it. The plot of the movie, if my memory serves, is that Matthew Perry wishes that he could go back to being in high school, being popular and being cool, and magically his wish is granted and he becomes Zac Efron.
I wish I could be Zac Efron.
Yeah. Wow. Was the movie any good? I remember thinking it was okay. It's currently got a 48 on Metacritic, so, you know, nothing pretty spectacular. But when the news broke of Matthew Perry's death, the friend of mine who I went to go see the movie with texted me, and she said to me, like, hey, you might not even remember this, but remember back in 2009 when we went to go see 17 again, what a stupid and fun movie it was, and how happy we were to see Matthew Perry, how happy we were to see Chandler from Friends in a movie. And at that time, High School Musical was really popular, and she was a fan of that. So it just, like, allowed me to take a walk down memory lane with a friend, and I was certainly thankful for that. And do you have any experience with him in the movies?
Two. Fools Rush In, which I'm not going to get into in depth because I'm actually going to talk about what we've been watching.
Mm-hmm.
And The Whole Nine Yards. The Whole Nine Yards is probably his most popular film. It's a comedy about, he is a guy and next door, Bruce Willis moves in next door, who turns out to be a former hitman for the mob who is hiding. I think he's under police protection. and hilarity ensues.
I bet.
Now, I like to have some fun with friends, and...
Not the TV show?
No. The every Friday, I send a Friday fun fact out to my friends, to a collection of people I know. I'll send them a fun little Friday fun fact. Do you want to know what my Friday fun fact was?
Sure.
What's the date of Matthew Perry's death? The Saturday or the Sunday? I can't remember.
It was, I had it up a second ago. It was the 28th, I think, whatever day that was. So that would be the...
That was a Tuesday.
That was a Tuesday?
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, all the 28th he died.
Okay, so here's my...
News would have broke on the Wednesday, I believe.
Okay. No, that can't be right.
It says died October 28th, and I remember the news saying that it was like last night in his hot tub, right? Wasn't that the case?
Okay, sadly, I'm looking at the... Now I get it. It's Saturday. I'm looking at November. I'm like, that was a day ago. Okay. All right. So my Friday fun fact for October 27th.
So day before he died.
You ready?
Yeah.
Bruce Willis only agreed to guest star on Friends after losing a bet with his whole nine yards co-star Matthew Perry. He played Jennifer Aniston's love interest on a 3-episode arc and won an Emmy for his performance. He donated his acting fee to 5 charities. I talked about Matthew Perry the day before he died.
Wow. Actually, I was as well. I was with my brother coming back from a concert we were attending in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot more, I mean, it was a 4-hour car ride, so there was a lot of ground to cover, and when my brother and I get together, it's usually just fucking talking about bullshit we saw when we were kids, or quoting movies we saw when we were kids, and Friends was definitely a part of that discussion. It wasn't a huge part of our childhood, but it definitely was on in our house, especially in my teen years.
Hold on, I'm trying to remember it. Try to remember the one quote you told me about on an episode.
Oh, yeah. I don't even know if I can remember.
I wanted to try and impress you with my memory of it, but now I can't pull it because I don't have the memory of that movie. It's the Jose Canseco quote from Liar Liar.
Yeah, I mean, simply just Jim Carrey yelling, "I'm Jose Canseco."
Yeah, that's what it is. That's what I thought it was, but I'm like, that doesn't sound right.
Yeah, I mean, there's a zillion from Liar Liar that are the case, but that would be one of them. At any rate, yeah, we were exchanging back and forth some of our favorite Chandler quotes just a day before, and then he texted me the following day. He's like, "Dude, like Matthew Perry just died." It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
You'll have to remind me if you were a Friends guy.
Okay, so that's what we're gonna get into here is his run on Friends. I was not. I didn't. As I've stated numerous times, I didn't watch TV in the 90s. The very first episode of Friends I ever watched was actually a Chandler Bing specific episode. So he was the main, and I thought the idea of the episode was really great. I'm not gonna bother looking it up, so for those Friends fans out there, if I butcher this, my apologies. He gets locked in a lobby with a very hot model. Yes, of an ATM lobby.
I know the exact one.
Okay.
I believe the exact line from him is, and I quote, when he's telling Joey, "I'm locked in an ATM vestibule with Jill Goodacre," or as he mutters it, "I'm locked in an ATM vestibule with Jill Goodacre."
So I didn't watch Friends in the 90s. I probably didn't watch Friends until it was over, when it was on DVD. Because my girlfriend at the time was a massive Friends fan. She had the collections, and I would watch it with her. My appreciation for that show grew immensely. It is incredibly funny and incredibly well done, and I can see why it was so popular. Watching it, I have now watched the full series of Friends, I would say 5 or 6 times easily, if not more. And then once I got back into watching TV, countless episodes out of order on reruns whenever it was on. While Chandler isn't my favorite character, he's up there. And this will come as no surprise to everybody that has listened to an episode of this. His friendship with Joey is easily my favorite part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Their friendship is so, I'm going to cry, is so real and so truthful and so earnest. It really hit me hard watching the show. I'll be honest, his death didn't really affect me. I'm not a big Massive Friends fan, but I couldn't fully understand why this would be devastating to a lot of people. Most of my favorite episodes or moments from the show probably, off the top of my head, involve Chandler. The two that come to the most, my two favorite episodes are the quote-unquote, air quote, whatever, the game show where the girls lose the apartment to the boys.
That's a classic. Like, that when you said favorite episode, that was the first one that came to mind
for me.
And
the other one is where they're getting ready to go to a black tie event with Ross, and mm-hmm. Joey puts on all of Chandler's clothes.
Fucking hysterical.
Chandler's reaction is priceless. The other... a really, really sweet moment that is highlighted with an extremely great comedic moment is when Chandler first tells Monica he loves her when she's wearing the turkey on her head.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really sweet moment. But what makes that moment even better is when Joey shows up and loses his mind because he's terrified of the turkey on the head. There's a lot of really great moments with Chandler, and I think the majority of my favorite moments on Friends were probably have Chandler involved in them. Matthew Perry had a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol. You can see it on the show when you watch it. His weight gain goes up and down, and he came through. He worked really hard, put himself back together. Who knows how many relapses he had after the show ended. But what I can say is Matthew Perry really enriched a lot of people's lives because of his role and performance on that show. That's one of the most beloved sitcoms of all time. And he was an integral part of the reason that show was so successful. He passed away way too soon. He will be missed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I too discovered Friends after the fact. When the show ended in 2004, depending on when in the year it was, I was likely, quick math, 7 years old. I probably had not yet turned 8 mm-hmm. that year. So, this is a show that I discovered after the fact. I agree. The episode... the one where they do the trivia in the apartment to decide who's gonna get to live there is probably the best episode of the show.
It's probably my number one.
And it gives us so many of the best lines from the show, including in my opinion, the best Chandler line. I'm sorry, the TV guide goes to Chandler Bong, yes. not Chandler Bing, and Chandler pipes in. Actually, it's Miss Chandler Bong. fucking fantastic. Mm-hmm. The ATM vestibule with Jill Goodacre, another absolute classic. Really what has been delightful for me this week has been having text chains with friends I haven't talked to in a long time, talking about friends. Friends that I talked to when I was in high school, when I was kind of starting to get into the show. Bonding over what was the best moment from this, who had the best line here, all that sort of stuff. In my opinion, Chandler was the best part of the show. I always felt that way. When I was growing up, I was very, very much intrigued by sarcastic characters on shows. I can think of three really big ones. One of them you won't know. When I was a kid, there was a kids show I watched called The Weekenders. Shout out to any people my age who know what the fuck that is.
No clue.
There was a really sarcastic character on that show named Tino, and I went, hey, that guy's the funniest character on this show. I'm gonna watch him and try to talk like him. Early teens, discovered That 70s Show. Thank you, Topher Grace and Eric Foreman. I was like, that guy's the funniest character on this show. And then mid-teens, I loved Chandler Bing. Chandler Bing I thought was the funniest character. It's really too bad that Matthew Perry was himself going through such horrible personal turmoil mm-hmm. at the time. But he gave me so many laughs through the years, and I hope he knows that he helped many people through troublesome times. In watching interviews with him in the time since he passed, it seems like he really doesn't want his legacy to be friends. He wants his legacy to be his work with addicts and helping people through addiction, helping people through tough times. But with that being said, I hope he knows that friends has been that thing for many people to help them through a troublesome time. It was for me, and it was for lots of other people that I know. And I hope that he knew that before he left.
I'm sure he did. Yeah. I'm sure he did. So yeah, Matthew Perry, you will be missed, my friend.
Sorry, I'm scrolling through a BuzzFeed listicle right now of best Chandler Bing moments. The episode when him and Phoebe almost kiss because she doesn't know that he knows she knows, sort of thing. Fuck, man. So many great moments. I straight up don't have the time to rewatch this show, but fuck, if I don't have half a mind to go home and watch the trivia episode after this, that's just a great episode of television right there.
Depending what time we get done tonight, maybe we will.
Oh, fuck yeah. I would love that. I would love that.
All right, we'll see what happens. All right, Sam, what have you been watching?
Right, okay, so I've got three this week, and two of them are very interesting theater experiences that I'd love to share. I'll start with the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Okay.
You sound not enthused to hear that.
It's not a good movie.
Oh, it's not even a little bit. No. A newly engaged couple have a breakdown in an isolated area and must seek shelter at the bizarre residence of Dr. Frank N. Furter. Mm-hmm. You watched this in theaters last year, right?
Was it
2 years ago?
2 years.
2 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
But you have done the whole like midnight screening
twice.
And what's your experience like?
It's an absolute blast.
It's fucking great.
It's an absolute blast. I cannot recommend it enough.
If you first of all have seen Rocky Horror and somehow enjoy it outside of the isolated at home scenario,
we're looking at you, Abby.
For the record, I actually had seen Rocky Horror a couple of times before my first theater experience.
So had I.
I think this was my third theater experience, probably my sixth or seventh watch overall. It is such a dumb movie. It makes no sense. It makes no attempt at making sense. Most of the performances are terrible, including a young Susan Sarandon, who's just really weird, and Barry Bostwick is just fucking wallpaper in the movie. But there is there's so much zany craziness to it that just lends itself to, I don't know, loving it sincerely. And it's so much fun. And I will say that this watch, one of the things that stood out to me is how genuinely good the performance of Tim Curry is.
It's unreal.
The performance of Tim Curry is actually super good in this really bad movie. Of course, what I should get to now is just the fact that if you're going to watch this movie, it has to be in a theater. It has to be in a theater with other people who love this movie, who love just pouring themselves into this stupid, bizarre fever dream of a film mm-hmm. Where nothing makes sense. And it was my third time doing it, and we bought the prop bag and we threw the toast. If you've never been to one of these midnight screenings, it's encouraged to yell things at the screen. It's encouraged to yell jokes. It's encouraged to throw things. I mean, not like anything, but they give you little prop bags where you throw things at certain times, and they give you a list of when you're supposed to throw them. Somebody says a toast and you throw a piece of toast. And a bunch of stuff like that. Somebody steps out in the rain and you squirt a little squirt gun into the air. And cover your head with a newspaper. It's all just fucking silly, good fun. and it's unlike any theater experience I've ever had. And there's a reason that people go back to it. There's a reason the theater's packed every single year. It's because it's so much fun to just be earnest and pour your heart into this stupid fucking movie. It's difficult for me to rate Rocky Horror Picture Show because the movie itself is not good.
It's a horrible movie. It's rating the experience.
Yeah, I'm rating the experience. I gave it a 4 myself. Because it's just too much fun. It would have gotten a 5 if the movie itself was actually better. But it's the experience.
What would you rate the movie, honestly?
Honestly, the movie's a 2 just because of Tim Curry.
I was going to say, I was like...
Just because of Tim Curry.
I was about to say, I'm like, it's a 1 for me.
Tim Curry is really genuinely awesome in it.
I'd have to rewatch it, but I refuse to. I will not watch this movie.
And honestly, even if I did watch it at home now, I don't think I would have fun. But I would remember all of my fun theater experiences and like when anytime like there's no way that if I'm watching this at home, I'm not yelling slut at my TV every time Janet comes on, right? And every time Barry Bostwick comes on, he's getting asshole for sure. So. Rocky Horror Picture Show got a 4 from me.
Just before you move on, again, to anyone listening, please, if you have never seen this movie, do not watch it at home. Wait for a screening at your local theater and go and be ready to be absolutely blown away at easily the best theater experience you will ever have.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Unless I really want to go to The Room. I really want to go to a live screening of The Room.
That's not happening.
You haven't even seen The Room. You can't even say whether it's better or worse than Rocky Horror.
There's no way it's better.
Yeah, it's bad. Okay, the other theater experience I had this week that was very unique was for a movie that has a positive reputation, actually, not as being a camp B-movie classic. This is the oldest film I have ever seen. The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1920. Hypnotist Dr. Caligari uses a somnambulist, Cesar, to commit murders. This was an experience. So what I meant by this being a unique theater experience for me was the Kamloops Film Society actually hired a pianist 5 weeks out from the screening and said, hey, we're looking for somebody to write an original score for this film and perform it live during the 76-minute runtime of this film. And a very talented young lady named Daniela O'Fee from Kamloops answered the bat signal. Was given 5 weeks to write a whole original score from scratch and learn to perform it in front of a huge crowd of people in time with a silent film. And before even getting into the movie, I need to give this woman massive props for performing a beautiful score. It was very, very classical and very, it was very, very classically informed, let's say. Like, it just sounded like a piece of classical piano.
Mm-hmm.
I say this as a compliment. Both Emma and I forgot she was there for a lot of the movie. There were many flashy sections, very, very showy, flashy sections, but they weren't the feature. It was all in service of the story, and for somebody who has no experience composing for film, she did a masterful job, and she completely disappeared behind the screen. Like, she was on stage in front of the screen, but I didn't even notice her, because she did such a good job of serving the film and setting the tone. There's a couple of moments that were downright magical, the way that she played to them, so I had to give her a shout-out real quick off the top, because she did a great job. It almost makes me sad that this was the way that I saw this movie, because I know that I never will be able to experience that exact film again, because the score will be different. Mm-hmm. So I'll never be able to experience that film the same way. So that's a bit of a bummer, but I'm glad that it happened. As far as the film itself, I was actually really impressed. The only other film I've seen that is like this is Nosferatu, mm-hmm. Which you and I both agreed was a fun kind of lesson in history, but ultimately as an entertainment piece didn't really hold up. It also has these really weird anti-Semitic undertones where all the vampires are like really hook-nosed and like long fingers and stuff. It's like a bit of the anti-Semitism in Germany at the time coming out in that. The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari I actually found very entertaining. I was having a great time. Again, partially my experience was elevated by the score for sure, and the adrenaline of that, but the film itself is actually very good. And when you watch films that are considered to be classics, I kind of expected to recognize some stuff. You know, when you watch Casablanca and like every third line is like the most famous line that's ever existed. You're like, oh, okay, I expected to. I remember that.
That's one of my favorite things about watching Casablanca with somebody who's never seen it. They're like, I can't believe how many famous lines are from that
movie.
You're
like, that's what that's from? Holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was expecting kind of the same with Dr. Caligari, not with lines because A, it's a silent movie and B, it's in German. But I was expecting certainly some visual cues that I would recognize or some plot points that I would recognize. And I actually didn't really get any of that. I found it to be a wholly original story that I didn't know what was going to happen. And I had a really great time with the film itself. The first moment where Cesar the somnambulist wakes up is a very magical moment. Actually, there's a beautiful close-up on his face, and whoever the actor was who was portraying Cesar actually does a very good job portraying him. But yeah, I found myself wholly invested in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Will I put on a 100-year-old German silent film in my own time? Maybe not, but I had a really good time in the theater. This got a 4 as well.
Sweet.
Do you know anything about this film? Or
I think I'm confusing this movie with something else, because by the name of it, I thought it was something from more like the 60s or 70s that was something kind of psychedelic and artsy. And that's why when you said you were doing it, I was like, I have no desire to go fucking see that.
Oh, yeah.
But now hearing what it is, maybe I'll check it out.
Yeah. It's as a little background, for you and for anybody listening who has even a passing curiosity about it, it was made in 1920. It's part of the German Expressionist film movement. It is considered to be the original horror film. It's one of the films that is considered to be the first ever. Is it even remotely scary? No. The actual fear of it, the horror of it, doesn't hold up in that way. There is at least one murder scene which is pretty eerie. Like, I'm not going to say it's completely devoid of anything creepy or eerie, but it just doesn't hold up. If you're a horror fan, you're hoping to be scared. This isn't the film.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a fan of silent movies, if you're curious at all about classics, this is one for you. I think part of the legacy of this film, on top of being one of the first, if not the first, horror movies ever made, is the sets. The sets are very psychedelic, like you had said. A lot of them are intentionally, I don't even know how to describe them, like obscured or there's a word. It's almost like all the sets are in italics, kind of. They're all just kind of diagonal and pushed back at the top, and they're all very askew. And sets of trees, like all the trees have very long, finger-like branches. Like, it's all just very off-putting and weird.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the set design is one of the big selling points of this film, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, that's enough on the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from me, unless you have anything else you want to add. But
no, I'm good.
The last one, the third Spooktober watch of the week. I finally, this has been on my watch list for over a year. I finally got to 1982's The Thing. A research team in Antarctica is hunted by a shape-shifting alien that assumes the appearance of its victims. Last year, the classic that I watched was The Fly, which I fucking loved. And this year, it was The Thing, which I also really, really, really enjoyed. This was so enjoyable. I'm not a huge scholar on the history of this film, but I believe this is one of the first, if not like the breakout performance for Kurt Russell. It's got to be among them, maybe. I mean, it's 40 years old, and Kurt Russell himself now is probably in his late 60s, I would imagine.
Well, you have to remember, Kurt Russell was a big Disney boy star.
Was he?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he was actually like a child star.
Yeah, you have I only know three actors from this film, I think. I'm just scrolling through to make sure that's the case. Yeah, so I only know Kurt Russell, Wilford Brimley, and Keith David. I've more heard of Wilford Brimley than actually seen him in anything. He's the diabetes guy. That's basically how I know him.
Well, that's how you know him?
That's how I know him, he's the diabetes guy. And Keith David, people my age will know Keith David probably from the final season of Community, or as the voice of the president from Rick and Morty, or as the voice of the cat from Coraline. He's a pretty accomplished voice actor with a very distinguished voice. And of course, this was directed by John Carpenter. My understanding of this film before going into it was that it is worth watching for the effects alone. The visual effects of this film are legendary. And as I understand it, this was not a film that was considered to be anything special at the time that it came out. But the visual effects in this film are clearly spectacular, and they have held up so well. And in the age of CGI, I don't think we'll ever get a film like this ever again. I don't think we'll ever see a film like The Thing, where all of the transformations look so good, so bloody, so fantastical, but also so lifelike. It is a marvel of cinema that this was able to be achieved. Now, there is more material just about the inner workings of the crew than I was expecting. I was expecting more monster gore. A solid chunk of the middle of this movie is just guys in an isolated location talking to each other, which is not something I'm opposed to. It was a very well-paced movie. It gets started basically right away, but there's almost sort of a dip in the middle, which I thought was strange. Anyway, at the end of the day, I decided to give The Thing a 4. Much like The Fly, I think I was a little bit hesitant to give The Fly a 5. I know that if I watched The Fly again now, it would probably get a 5. Probably the same with The Thing. I gave it a 4 off the top. I would not be surprised to see this move up to a 5 on a rewatch. Really, Manny, I know that you're not the biggest horror movie guy in the world. this is part of the cognitive dissonance that I imagine you must endure. The fact that you love classics and hate horror. This is arguably like the quintessential horror movie of the 80s. One of them. 70s, I feel like, was the era of the slasher. The Friday the 13th of the world, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. This was sort of a horror sci-fi, the beginning of a horror sci-fi crossover that would continue through the 80s. I really enjoyed The Thing and will hopefully be revisiting it before too long.
This has been on my watch list for decades, and I just never get around to getting to watch it. Full disclosure, this is the one I was hoping was going to win the Halloween Horror.
Yeah, I was hoping so too. We had a good time doing Interview with a Vampire.
I really did.
But in case you were wondering if we were putting our finger on the scales at all, we're not, because we were both kind of hoping that The Thing would win.
Yeah, it lost by one vote.
Yeah. Bitter pill. I had to watch it anyway. I had to.
Yeah, it's fine. It's totally fine. To just quickly circle back to the Kurt Russell thing, this was around the time that he became a major movie star. He was a pretty known actor already through growing up with Disney. He'd had a really big, a very popular movie playing Elvis Presley that kind of set him, but that set everything in motion, as he has used cars, Escape from New York. He voices Copper in The Fox and the Hound. Then he has The Thing. The next year, he's nominated for an Oscar in Silkwood. Then he's got Swing Shift and Mean Season, The Big Trouble in Little China, Overboard, Tequila Sunrise, all in the 80s. Finishing off the 80s with Tango and Cash. A really fun action movie with Sylvester Stallone. He was a really big star. This was kind of on the big upward trajectory that he was on. The Thing is a movie I am looking forward to watching at some point. I have no idea when, but it's on my list, and I know it will knock it off eventually.
I didn't know that Kurt Russell had a little bit of a baseball career as well.
Oh, really?
Played some minor league ball. Nice. Played in the Class A league in the Angel system, and then moved to Double A for the El Paso Sun Kings in the Texas League.
Nice.
He was a in the field pivot, so he was middle infielder. It looks like.
All right.
Yeah. Cool. Good for him. We love a good baseball player around here.
We do. Okay, getting to what I've been watching. With Matthew Perry passing away, I decided to kind of kill two birds with one stone. That was really poor choice of words. Ooh. There. I apologize. But
kill a chicken and a duck with one stone.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I got to watch a Matthew Perry movie, and it's a 1997 movie, which is the next miniseries we'll be starting shortly. He's in a romantic comedy with Salma Hayek called Fools Rush In. After a one-night stand with Alex, Isabel realizes that she is pregnant, and they decide to get married. However, along with the marriage comes compromise of one's own cultural traditions. This is your standard... Yeah, I know. Why don't you share what you're grimacing about?
Yeah, Manny is reacting to the grimace I have on my face, because I'm looking at the 37 Metascore on this.
Yeah, it is a shining bright red 37
the
Metascore.
The plot does not lead me to believe that it is erroneously labeled as a 37 Metascore.
This is actually... I enjoyed this. I went in watching this expecting it to be an absolute travesty, and what I found instead was something that was more enjoyable than I remember. It's not quite the culture clash movie that you're thinking. It's not like this white guy and a Mexican woman, and he's white, she's Mexican, and
oh, how are they gonna reconcile this?
Don't get me wrong, there is some of that, especially spoiler alert, when his parents show up. There is a scene on a houseboat that gets. Like, it's racist. Let's just be honest. It plays right into some racial stereotypes. Mm-hmm. What I found sweet was for the majority of the film, they are trying to make an honest effort out of their relationship. They literally have a one-night stand and don't see each other. She comes back 3 months later when she finds out she's pregnant. It's not like Knocked Up, where she goes to him like a week later. Mm-hmm. This is 3 months later. They literally have a one-night stand. She comes back, and they're hanging out, and he decides he's going to ask her to marry him, and they try to make it work. And the best thing about it is that they legitimately try to make it work. It's not about how these two people who don't know each other are butting heads constantly. There is a cultural difference. There are some things that are enjoyable to watch. She, being a Catholic in a Latino family... It is a very large family. They have these family dinners every weekend, every Sunday, I think, and there's like 40 people there. And for him, that is a shock. And it's not played for the laughs that you think. It's played for, isn't that cool?
Mm-hmm.
Like, look at what she has. And they really play up to that, and I enjoyed it. They have decent chemistry. He's not very far removed from Chandler Bing.
He's kind of still in his wheelhouse.
He is.
Just being the funny, lanky, sarcastic yep. dork.
The big problem with this movie is, as with every rom-com, there has to be some type of... What's the word I'm looking for? Trip up, some type of conflict that drives them apart for them to come back together. And that's where the main problem in this movie is, because the conflict makes him look like a complete fucking douchebag.
Hmm.
And not in the sense that he's not really spoiling anything. It's not because he falls in love with somebody else or anything like that. He just becomes a fucking prick.
And yeah, that's too bad. It's a bit contrived.
It is. It's a bit contrived because there's their relationship as they're working on this marriage that they're trying to make work is very wholesome and earnest. And then out of almost nowhere, he seems to abandon that type of effort, and it doesn't make much sense, and it's really harsh, especially considering how hard Salma Hayek's character is trying.
Hmm.
And for that, it hurt the movie a little bit, and the big ending, the big reunited scene is a little hard to take. You're like,
It was like he was kind of an asshole to you.
Yeah. So for that, I gave it a 3. I gave it a 3 out of 5. It is a perfectly enjoyable film. It is a run-of-the-mill, lower-tier romantic comedy. Not low-end, lower.
Hmm.
Not quite mid-tier, lower. But I still give it a 3 out of 5. I'll be perfectly honest. Salma Hayek is stunningly beautiful and very charming in this movie. Matthew Perry is... really good for most of it, except for when he becomes the asshole, and then it's kind of hard to take. But I had a decent time. 3 out of 5.
Hmm.
Next up is this round's Manny Movie Club pick, chosen by Jordan. It's Lady Macbeth. In 19th century rural England, a young bride who has been sold into marriage discovers an unstoppable desire within herself as she enters into an affair with a worker on her estate. This stars Florence Pugh, so I was excited for that. And yet again, we have Florence Pugh in a movie that she is too good to be in.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is a garbage. It is boring.
She's got to fire her fucking agent, man.
Yes.
She's been in some turds.
Yes. This movie was so boring and so weirdly edited. You had scenes that lasted maybe 30 seconds, and then they would cut to another scene. It was oddly edited. I found it jarring at times. And these scenes, sometimes as they would go, didn't seem to carry any weight for the film. Also, this affair that she starts with her, for lack of a better word, help, not slave, but like a worker on the estate, had zero buildup. Like zero buildup. I have no idea, other than the fact she was in a completely loveless and sexless marriage, what she found attractive in this guy.
Hmm.
Florence Pugh is the only reason to see this movie, but I would direct you to other movies with her in it over this in a heartbeat. Thankfully, this movie was 1 hour and 29 minutes. Sam, I won't lie, it felt like 2.5 hours. It dragged. There are two incredible scenes, though, that made it worth watching. And other than that, this is a complete skip. I cannot recommend this movie.
The male lead, Cosmo Jarvis.
Okay.
Don't recognize him from anything.
Yeah, well, he's pretty unimpressive in this movie.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Not a fan. Didn't like it. 2 out of 5.
Ooh, tough.
Yep.
Tough on Lady Macbeth.
Yep. And by the way, if you're thinking that this is a Shakespeare play, it is not, by the way.
Which feels like that's intentional. Feels like, well, we've got nothing else to market. Okay, we put Florence Pugh as the only thing on the poster. Check. Because she's the only reason that you should go see it. Maybe we can trick somebody into thinking this is intellectual property. Maybe. Throw Lady Macbeth on there. I guess because there was already too many Spider-Man movies that came out in the last 3 years, they couldn't call it Spider-Man.
Who knows?
So went, fuck it, Lady Macbeth.
They should have called this Joker.
Yeah, Joker. Yeah, as much relation to the source material as the actual Joker movie, right?
Yeah. Next up was a movie that I had seen pop up on Amazon, and the premise had me so completely intrigued that despite my lack of interest in the genre, I decided to watch it. Because it is more of a comedy horror than a horror comedy.
Okay.
That movie is called Totally Killer. When the infamous Sweet 16 killer returns 35 years after his first murder spree to claim another victim, 17-year-old Jamie accidentally travels back in time to 1987, determined to stop the killer before he can start. This movie was a lot of fucking fun.
That sounds fun. It sounds like a good plot.
It was. Now, anybody interested in this movie, I want to put this on Front Street right now. I'm not spoiling anything. It's there in the plot. She travels back to 1987. You have to just accept the premise of how she gets back there. Just let it go, because it makes no sense whatsoever. There's nothing to preclude this thing happening. There's just all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's a time machine. And you're just like, what the fuck? Okay, done. And if you can do it, you will have a really good time. Now, I'm going to spoil a little bit about this movie because I actually want to try and sell it a little bit. So I'm not going to spoil massive things. I'm going to spoil some of the enjoyment I got from this movie. The lead actress, Kiernan Shipka, is the daughter from Mad Men. And so this movie is set in 2023, and she travels back to 1987. What made this partly enjoyable for me is watching a modern teenager try to deal with the social and political landscape of 1987, where there is no wokeness, there is no political correctness, where there is bullying openly and accepted, and people are shitty to each other, and we accepted it, and we dealt with it, and she has a hard time with it. That was very enjoyable to watch. She also runs into her mom and dad in the past. So I'm going to kind of spoil this part. Her mom and dad don't get together until college. So it was fun watching her see her dad make out with other chicks. And she's completely grossed out by it. It's also fun. This was the other part I enjoyed. She runs into her mother, and her mom's a bitch and is so mean to her. It was a lot of fun. I had a really great time with this movie. I had a really great time. It's just not quite made well enough for it to be a movie that I will revisit often. I only gave it a 3 because I don't see myself coming back to this movie regularly. But it had a fun premise. It had okay performances. They weren't bad, but they weren't quite good enough. And I think it's because of that it drops to a 3. But I still had a very good time with this movie, so it gets a 3.
Cool. I was actually expecting this to get a 4. You were talking about it in very you had a big smile on your face.
I did, because the movie was a lot of fun. It's just that the acting, if you watch this movie, you'll watch it, you'd be like, if they just had a few better actors in this, this could be Scream level fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not quite there. But I do recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
Next up was a movie I was looking forward to watching. It's called Old Dads. Written, directed, and starring Bill Burr. Three best friends become fathers later in life and find themselves battling preschool principals, millennial CEOs, and anything created after 1987. That's amazing. So, this movie, are you a Bill Burr fan? You watch his stand-up?
I'm not, like, specifically a Bill Burr fan. He pops up in my, my YouTube shorts and Instagram reels and all that stuff. I think he's a funny guy.
Okay.
I wouldn't call myself a fan, but I like him.
Okay.
He's a good dude.
I am a fan. Part of the reason I'm a fan is because I'm an older male.
Yeah.
Who is very irritated with wokeness.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Burr is very irritated with wokeness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the premise of this movie. Sure. Bill Burr probably wrote, directed, and starred in this so he could make a movie about shitting on the political and social structures of today.
Yeah.
And it was fun to watch him do so.
Mm-hmm.
He's fine in the movie. It definitely lacks a strong direction. It's definitely none too subtle about its thoughts on today's society as he takes every opportunity he can to shit all over almost every type of aspect of today's culture, like how your child's future is determined by a recommendation by his kindergarten teacher,
mm-hmm,
of getting into private school, how CEOs run their business by not really caring about their employees and are more interested in bottom line and efficiency and changing, buying one company and completely changing what that company is to try and suit modern times, despite how successful that current company is.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun to watch him rip those ideas apart. As an older male, yeah, I had a really great time with it. The movie doesn't quite work in some aspects, but being a Bill Burr fan, I had a enjoyable time. It was a 3 out of 5 for me.
You know that that Simpsons meme that makes the rounds every now and again? It's a newspaper clipping of Grandpa Simpson and it says, "Old man yells at cloud."
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what the description of this film sounds like to me. It sounds like this might not be directed at me or directed at, you know, it sounds like it has its audience. And it was made by Bill Burr for Bill Burr, basically, which is fine. I have mixed feelings on Bill Burr. I think he's an incredibly funny dude.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even bother me that he goes as far as he does on some of the controversial topics he goes to. He's not afraid to, quote, go there.
No, he's not.
I think he's wrong about some stuff, but I think he's a funny guy. And I you know, respect him for saying some of the things that he says. This does not strike me as it being the film for me.
I do not think that you would enjoy this movie.
Yeah, probably not.
Nope.
If it was made, like, it sounds like it was made for people in your generation.
Yep.
And you thought it was okay from the sounds of it. That's not a good sign.
I thought it was okay because I'm a fan of film.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that, and this is not to demean them, I guarantee you a casual moviegoer of my age will watch this and love it for what he says and does to people in this movie.
For sure.
Yes.
Yeah. 42 Metascore. Not encouraging.
Yeah.
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 Glad you liked it. I'll probably skip.
The last movie I watched, it had been on my watch list for a while, but it was a movie I promised a friend that I would watch, a coworker of mine. Basically, I'm watching it as a reward for him to do something that would better his life. I said, if you do this, I will watch this movie, and he did it immediately, and his life is better for it.
Nice.
Yes. So this is a 1985 war film called Come and See.
I have heard nothing but incredible.
Joins the Soviet resistance movement against ruthless German forces and experiences the horrors of World War II. Now, this doesn't have a Metascore on it, but if I'm not mistaken, I think the Letterboxd score is 4.5.
Yeah, last time, it's one of the highest rated films on Letterboxd right now.
Yeah, and it is easy to see why. Sam, this film is... It's just short of 2.5 hours. It doesn't feel it. The movie is about the horrors of war without really being about the horrors of war. Similar to, or unlike the movie we're reviewing next week, which is All Quiet on the Western Front, which graphically displays the horrors of war, what this movie shows is the psychological trauma of a country at war. And how the citizens and how this young boy try to deal with the idea of war in their own country. It is absolutely riveting. It is incredibly harrowing. The best part of the film is right at the end. He comes to a village, and it is almost at the level of the liquidation of the ghetto from Schindler's List. And then there are repercussions of that scene afterwards that was mesmerizing to watch.
Hmm.
And then from that point on, there is a, I think, you're like, there's like 10 minutes left in the film.
Mm-hmm.
They do something at the very end of the movie that really pulled me out of the film. I don't know why they chose to do something like that. I can't get into it without, even though it's not even a spoiler, like I could actually tell you exactly what it was and it wouldn't spoil the movie. But for people wanting to watch this movie, I want them to go in and see how they feel when this happens in the film. I had the hardest time trying to decide what to rate this movie because it is an undeniably brilliant film. Absolutely, breathtakingly brilliant. How they got a performance from this young man like this is mind-blowing. I really, really, really wanted to give this movie a 4 because I don't see myself really ever wanting to watch this again. Not because of its harrowing subject matter, but in all honesty, it's not a fully entertaining film.
Hmm.
It's just something so incredibly well made. You'll be happy. If someone wants to watch this over and over again, fucking awesome. Power to you. I'm fucked up because how people would want to watch this movie over and over again is the same way that I get enjoyment out of watching Schindler's List over and over again. And I can understand why some people would never want to watch Schindler's List again after having seen it. This movie, for me, just didn't hold a rewatchability figure. But I ended up giving it a 5 because I can't deny how incredibly great this film was made and how incredible it is as a movie. So it got a 5 for me based on the skill and technical prowess of the film.
Wow.
Yeah. But I don't see myself – I will never be at a moment where I'm going to be like, I'm going to watch Come and See.
I say this about most of the movies you say that about, though. Like, you'll probably find yourself years down the line just being like, I remember really liking that and revisiting it.
It's possible.
Call it 10 years down the line.
That's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know.
Within the next, I do not see myself watching this again in the next 5 years.
Yeah, for sure. It is definitely on my watch list. It's a 4.6.
So it's even higher. Fucking 4.6.
It is one of the highest. I wish I would have pulled it up, but it's one of the highest rated films on Letterboxd. I have 4 friends, including you, who have logged this movie. 3 of them gave it a 5. The other one gave it a 4. So average rating of 4.75 holds pretty true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about this movie, and I like it that way. So I'll hopefully get a chance to watch it. What is it? Is it on anything?
So
looks like you can buy a DVD on Amazon.ca, or you can rent it on YouTube for a price.
I decided to bite the bullet because I was so angry that I missed so many films for 1990 that I subscribed to the Criterion Channel.
Wow.
I paid for it for 1 year, and if I can watch, thinking of rental prices, like between $5 to $6 to rent a movie, if I can watch 20 films off of that network, then I will have paid for itself. So I don't see that being a problem. So we'll see.
I'm going through the top rated films on Letterboxd.
Mm-hmm.
So number 1 is Harakiri from 1962 from Masaki Kobayashi.
Okay.
Rated a 4.7.
All right.
Which is insane. The next one is a series, so it doesn't count. It's a Band of Brothers, which I've heard is great. But it's a series.
Unfucking believable.
Yeah, but it's a series. And then next one technically counts, I believe, funnily enough. I think it's the movie that my girlfriend is at right now. It's Stop Making Sense, the 1984 documentary directed by Jonathan Demme.
Mm-hmm.
About the Talking Heads. And the next one after that is Cowboy Bebop, which I believe is also a series, if I'm not mistaken. Is there a length on that? Yeah, so I don't think that one counts. So we got one actual film, one documentary, and 2 series, and then Come and See.
Yeah.
Number 5, technically, but really number 3, if we're just counting films.
I'll be honest. I think one of the reasons that this movie is rated so high is because an average filmgoer isn't going to seek this movie out. They're never going to see this on Netflix and put this on.
Mm-hmm.
So I could understand numerous people I know that would watch this movie and be like, oh God, that was kind of boring. I'm going to give it a 3. But those people aren't going to watch this movie. Right now it's hard to watch. I'm not giving it, I gave it a 5. So it's as good as it is, but it's not a popular film. So it being high, what are the views on it?
Views on Come and See. Let me see. We've got, let me pull this up full screen real quick. What are the views? How can I even see this? It's got 10,000 fans. I don't know what that means on here. Okay, we got 256,000 watches.
Yep.
And 106,000 likes. Number 2 in the Letterboxd top 250.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I could have just looked at that. Letterboxd top 250, top 250 narrative films sorted by Letterboxd rating. It's number two behind Harakiri.
What's the highest rated film on there that's a populist film? Like, what, like I know The Dark Knight will be high, but I don't want to use
populist,
that one.
I don't know. Shawshank is probably the most populist in the top 10. Actually, Parasite. Parasite number seven. Okay. It depends on how you... There's a couple movies in there that I've heard of, like, that are American films, like 12 Angry Men, Godfather Part 2, Godfather Part 1, Seven Samurai are all in the top 10. But as far as what you consider, like, widely acclaimed by Western audiences, Parasite is probably the highest ranked at number 7.
Okay, so Parasite. How are you still in Come and See?
I can be.
Okay, can you go back there? Did you say it was like 250,000?
256.
Okay. Well, how many people do you think have seen Parasite?
I think Parasite is the most logged film on Letterboxd, if I'm not mistaken.
It's 3 million.
Yeah.
So that's the difference for me. Like, what else?
Shawshank is on there. 1.7 mil.
More people have seen logged Parasite than Shawshank? That's fucked up.
It's also not surprising because Parasite's a modern film.
Yeah.
Like, it came out while Letterboxd was alive. Godfather, 1.6 million. Yeah, so there's a bunch of that.
See, that makes me...
Schindler's List, a little under a million, 992K.
That's fucked up.
Yeah.
That's stupid low.
The most recent film in the top 20... Actually, across the Spider-Verse is in there, yeah.
Do you know it was number one for a while?
I do, but that's like... I don't really count that, I guess. I don't know. It seems like an initial wave. You're familiar with the term phantom menacing? It's like there's some phantom menacing going on there of just an initial wave of hype elevating the film's status a little bit before we kind of cool off.
Oh, wasn't I talking with you? If you go into the reviews of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, there's numerous ones in there where people gave it a half star because they're like, it doesn't deserve to be
across,
this highly...
Across the universe, yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't deserve to be this high. It doesn't deserve to be this high on Letterboxd, so I'm giving it this rating. And I'm like, you're a piece of shit.
Yeah, I can't imagine having that occupy your mind that much that you're intentionally trying to sway it.
Whatever. All right. That's what we've been watching.
Spirited Away is number 25, by the way, and I just rewatched that, and I don't get it.
Fair enough. I really need to rewatch Parasite.
Yeah. Me too. I gave it a 4. I've seen it like 3 times.
I've still only seen it once.
I think I've seen it 3 times. Hold on. How many times have I seen Parasite? Let's see. Oh, really? I just have one.
There you go.
In my head, I've watched it more than that.
Well, maybe you didn't log it, you cheater.
Maybe. Maybe, all right. Maybe.
Let's get into this week's review.
I probably wasn't using Letterboxd the first time I watched it.
Oh, fair.
That's probably what it was.
All right, because that's a 2019, right?
Yeah, I think I've seen it twice.
All right. Let's get into our review of Palm Springs. Released July 10th, 2020, directed by Max Barbacow, written by Andy Sierra and Max Barbacow, starring Andy Samberg, Kristen Milioti, and J.K. Simmons, has a Metascore of 83. Letterboxd score of 3.8. It's fucking good scores.
Mm-hmm.
Had a budget of $5 million, and it made $1.5 million.
Yeah, but it was on streamers, and it was pandemic.
The plot, stuck in a time loop. Two wedding guests develop a budding romance while living the same day over and over again. Samuel, why don't you share your spoiler-free thoughts on Palm Springs?
All right. Palm Springs. This is a film that means a lot to me. For a little bit of context, Manny, as you know, in the... What is it, 2023? In the roughly 3 years that I've been using Letterboxd, I have not logged the film that I consider to be my favorite, which is Inglourious Basterds. I have yet
what?
I've yet to actually log that film in those 3 years. So that is a brief bit of context for when I tell you that I've seen this film no fewer than 5 times in 3 years since it came out. So that is unheard of. It is among my most watched in Letterboxd. How many times have you logged Pulp Fiction in the last, since you've been using Letterboxd?
Oh, fuck, you're a dick.
Sorry, you're looking up something else. I'm asking other questions.
Okay, give me 1 second.
It's fine. But yeah, I just wanted to give that. Man, he's holding up the number 4. He's logged Pulp Fiction 4 times. So I just wanted to give that context because it's rare for me to even watch a movie twice or even once. in how busy my life is now. And I've watched this 5 times in 3 years because it's quick, it's easy, and it's fun. It also, like many of my favorite films, it found me at the perfect time in my life. And a unique experience that I hope to get more of, because I've been using Letterboxd for a while now at this point, is that I can tell you the exact day that this film walked into my life. It was January 24th, 2021. That is the first time I logged Palm Springs, and I'm confident that was the first time I actually watched it. I was on the brink of a career change. I can actually tell you that was 5 days before I had my last day at my job. So my 2 weeks notice was already in at a job I was working that I didn't really like anymore, that I had once loved, but I was kind of falling out of love with. I was on the brink of a career change, and I didn't know it at the time, but I would be about 3 months removed from moving back to BC at that time. So this was at a very large period of change in my life, and I found this weird little movie about Andy Samberg, a character who loves stagnation, hates change, likes to go with the flow, has learned to embrace the mundanity in his life, and all of a sudden some change comes into his life and throws it for a whirlwind, and he's fucking scared. And that is just something that I needed to see at that point in my life, which feels like so long ago. It's really only 2.5 years ago, but I really needed that at that time. Furthermore, it was in the middle of a pandemic that you may have heard about, and it's kind of simultaneously about what to do when you have insane amounts of time on your hands, how to bond with somebody that you have no choice but to spend time with. I found it to be about a guy who feels imprisoned and grows used to his cell. And every watch, I feel like I peel another layer back on this film. I see it in a lot of different ways. This time, I saw it mostly as being about companionship. I saw it mostly about long-term companionship. The structure of the film is kind of a stand-in for marriage itself. How to reconcile with the fact that you are just with this one person forever now, and how to make the best of that. It's about keeping secrets, and it's about living with bad things that you've done and hiding a part of yourself from somebody else. It resonates with me so very deeply. It really does. And that is on top of being hysterically funny. Hysterically funny. I still laugh out loud so many times in this movie. I like it more every single time. Andy Samberg is funny and acts very well. Krista Milioti is fucking hysterical. She is comedically easily the highlight of the movie. She carries every scene that she's in, and she's fucking great. J.K. Simmons, in a smaller part, he is one of the best comedic dramatic actors in the world. When I think of him, I think of J. Jonah Jameson. I think of Terrence Fletcher from Whiplash. And I think of this. I think of Roy. Those are the three roles that I think of him in. All of those have dramatic parts and they have comedic parts. He is such a funny man and also such a great dramatic actor. Obviously, Oscar winner in the case of Whiplash. If you're listening to this and you haven't seen the film, I know we always give a spoiler warning, but I will like double ask you, if you haven't seen this movie, to not listen past the spoiler warning, because the first 15 minutes of this film play so well if you don't know what's going on. I was lucky enough to go into this film completely blind, and it elevated my experience completely. In case you can't tell, I still fucking love this movie. So yeah, this is a recent favorite of both mine and Manny's, and I'm gonna pass it off to Manny here in short order, because he's been waiting patiently as I ramble. But this is a film that continues to mean so much to me, and I will rewatch this very much, as this film will stick with me for a while.
That was incredibly eloquent. That was mind-blowingly delicious to hear. Your breakdown and your dissection of the themes and ideas that this movie presents was, in all honesty, awe-inspiring. This movie came on my radar when I heard it got picked up. A little piece of trivia: got picked up at Sundance for the most amount of money ever paid for a film. And when when the pandemic hit and it wasn't going to go to theaters, and I heard it was playing on Hulu, which we don't have here in Canada, it was very sad because some of the podcasts I was listening to were raving about how fun and ingenious this movie was. So when it finally hit Amazon, I was very excited. Or did I rent it? I can't remember. The moment it was available, I watched it and was blown away. Absolutely blown away by how inventive and fun and touching that the movie was. And I told Sam, you need to watch this.
I failed to mention in my long ramblings that this was a Manny recommendation. Do not read anything about the movie. Yep. Go in blind.
And because knowing you, that I knew that if you went in blind, your enjoyment of this movie would skyrocket. I wish that we had mentioned that earlier on in this episode, that if you go in completely blind, not even knowing the plot, the movie is even better. And sadly, I did know the plot when I got to watch it the first time. I would have loved to have seen your reaction when you realized the time loop thing.
Dude, one of the most memorable... We talk about our most memorable theater experiences. I was, of course, watching this at home during the pandemic, but one of my most memorable experiences watching a movie is the delivery of the line, "You're a sick fuck, Roy." Like, that moment, which I know you know what I'm referring to.
Yep.
I'm like, holy shit, this is amazing. I had no idea what was happening, but I knew that it was something special. And roughly a minute and 20 seconds later, when you figure it out, you're like, that's fucking brilliant.
This movie is one that has grown on me with each viewing and is a movie that I thoroughly enjoy watching. I think after the last... So I'm sitting at 6 times I've watched this movie since it came out. I would say after the 4th viewing. So viewing 4, 5, and 6 is really when I really started to feel that Christian Milioti took over the movie. The first few times, it was kind of like a 50-50. Andy Samberg's really funny, and there's lots of good stuff. But after you kind of move past the comedy of it, and you start to notice other aspects of it, she really starts to stand out. She is, of course, hilarious, but she has some truly incredible moments that are, when you're watching this movie in a more critical sense, which she did for this viewing, it's kind of mind-blowing. And I can't wait to discuss them with you. So why don't we go into spoilers? Sam, why don't you take us into spoilers today?
All right, Palm Springs. You really should watch this movie. You really, really should, in case you didn't get it from our spoiler-free discussion. We're about to spoil it. Here we go. 3, 2, 1, go fuck yourself.
Sam, where are you starting off?
Manny, the thing that you're doing right now, can you also do that for me as well?
Yep.
Sweet. Thank you. I don't know why I'm acting like it's one big secret. I just want you to pass me a can of Coke.
Why don't we open at the same time?
Let's do it.
3, 2, 1.
Very appropriate for Palm Springs as well.
Agreed.
We hear that sound a lot as well. That wasn't even planned. That's good. Cheers, baby. That is delicious.
Spilled some.
Spilled some. Where do I want to go? I am going to start with Niles seducing Sarah. So I have that.
Okay, I got you beat.
Okay, you got one before that?
I do.
Let's go.
All right. It'll play right into yours, because I'm picking up... Well, maybe it's at the same time. So I have Niles making the Maid of Honor speech.
Yeah, it kind of depends how much I'm allowed to include.
Okay.
Because, right from that moment...
I'm assuming you're talking about when they leave to the desert.
Yeah, I was...
Or is it when he's brought 2 drinks?
So here's the thing. I really... Knowing what we find out later in the film, which is that Niles and Sarah have slept together many times, and that Niles kind of knows the sequence of moves that makes it happen without fail, I view this speech as the beginning of the seduction. I really do.
Okay, that's cool. So we're on the same scene.
Yeah.
Well, he reveals in a scene later on that this is
the he's like, all I have to do is make the speech and you're good to go every time.
Yeah. Okay. Since we're pushing it, it's your scene, fire away.
Yeah. For reasons we'll reveal maybe in a little bit, we listened to a brief bit of audio from this scene before we came on air, and there's this one beautiful moment. It's a tiny little thing in the scene that makes me so happy.
Yes.
And it's when Andy Samberg is doing a speech, and he says, Abe and Tala, and he says their whole names with their middle names, like, who do not look like siblings, and there's this cut to Kristen Milioti as she's in the middle of drinking
wine.
It's
a spit take.
It's like a little spit take. It's not like, it's not over the top. It's not full, like, spitting out all her wine, but she is trying not to.
It's back into her glass.
Yeah, it's back into her glass. Fucking great.
Fantastic.
Great editing choice to put that there. And also just great, great small performance from Kristen Milioti. First time I watched this film, I felt then and still feel now that this is a great subversion of expectation. You fully expect this to be a train wreck. The first time you watch this movie, you're like, uh-oh, this is about to be embarrassing. This strange man in this Hawaiian shirt is going to make an ass of himself. But he saves the whole fucking day. He makes a beautiful, rousing speech.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that I kind of put Niles' seduction as one scene is because like a minute or two later, when they're discussing, you didn't really mean all of that, did you? And he says, of course not, we're all fucking alone. the callback to that is really great. Also included in here is, in between those two moments, you get the Niles dance,
yes,
which is fucking gorgeous.
Unbelievable.
It is edited, so I have to imagine there are some mistakes that are being kind of edited over. This feels like the kind of moment that, in the hands of a better director, this would be a one take.
Yes.
This would be a one-er. But regardless, this scene of Niles maneuvering the dance floor, knowing everybody's moves, is the kind of moment that, when you don't know the plot, you're like, what the fuck is this movie that I'm watching?
Yep.
Like, this guy is just the master of this universe. He nailed this speech, and now he's nailing the moves on the dance floor, and he's about to nail Kristen Milioti.
You're like, is this Ferris Bueller?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, this dude's fucking unreal. But yeah, him, the part that really gets me in the dance sequence is when he hops in between the two people. One of them's about to, like, fake spank the other, is like, smack somebody's ass, and he just hops in between while neither of them are looking.
Yep.
Great physical comedy from Andy Samberg. This is a great part of the movie.
I agree. I only had, for me, I cut off the scene as just the first wedding. So when Sarah kind of turns him down from the dance, that's where I cut myself off,
because
I wanted to keep the scene short. But this is technically part of the seduction, so I guess depending on how you want to label the scene, it still works. So this is where mine ends, is at the end of the dance. Yours continues on from here. So
yeah, I'm kind of cheating because I had to cut so many fucking scenes. We stated in a previous episode that we should get one mulligan per year, or we can just ignore the rules.
Yes.
I was sitting there with, like, 7 quotes and 8 scenes, and I was like, do I want to use them all again? And I was like, no, I'll just cheat. Like, I'll just kind of condense a couple into one, and we made it work. We fit it all in there.
Well, fair. Did you want to continue on with the seduction? Are you going into the desert or not?
I mean, just, am I going into the desert? I mean, really, just briefly, I mentioned it off the top, but I just want to say that the moment where Niles gets hit by the arrow,
yes,
is a beautiful moment for those going in blind. Because it is truly a moment of chaos, of just what the fuck is even happening.
If you don't know what this movie is about, if you go in blind, your reaction may be the same as Sarah's.
Yeah. Yeah, and by the way, holy shit, her reaction sells this scene. She's, like, absolutely fucking terrified. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant acting by everybody involved. And I love how Andy Samberg does seem surprised to get hit by the arrow, but again, the fact that he's not even surprised when he's like, ah, I thought I smelled you, is a great bit of reaction. And the juxtaposition between his lack of surprise that Roy just shot him with an arrow and Kristen Milioti's sheer and utter terror that her and Niles might be in danger, the difference between those two reactions makes the scene just super funny.
Mm-hmm. I agree. What is your next scene then?
My next scene is, it is one scene. I have the boredom montage when Sarah really starts leaning into, it's the montage that starts with the line, "Let's waste some time." So we see, them drinking in the pool, shooting, driving out of the sunroof. We get bomb and the cake.
Okay. So I have this whole thing. I call it time loop shenanigans.
Yeah. Okay. I called it a boredom montage because it just is about them trying to stave off boredom in this infinite fucking reality.
I never thought of it that way, but I can understand why. Yeah. So them, shooting the guns, I never saw it before, but you see them practicing the dance routine that they do earlier.
Yes.
I don't know how I missed that before.
It's great.
Some death. Her out falling out of the sunroof.
Yep.
Very funny.
He knows that pain is real, so he's a little too jubilant off the hop. He should probably make sure she's dead first, but he just thinks it's hilarious.
The airplane. I wanted to call them lessons, but they just hijack an airplane and then crash and die.
Yeah.
And then the dance routine at the bar, what I love so – it's little touches is that they've been practicing. They have millennia to practice, and even after that, it's still not that good.
Yeah.
No. It is not perfectly synchronized. It is not
– the moves are not flashy.
No. I love it.
Yeah.
100% I want to learn this routine. Yeah. I can't remember – I got to quickly look at the character's name.
Are you thinking of Darla?
Randy.
Randy.
Sarah fucking with Randy, so she makes him go in on Trevor and Misty. Absolutely hilarious. Them giving themselves tattoos. Mm-hmm. Awesome. The bomb and the cake.
The bomb in the cake is absolutely a highlight of the film. And it's, again, Kristen Milioti is fucking hysterical. Her French accent or whatever it is, she's trying to... Fire, you son of a bitch!
And then his millionth birthday, because she has no idea how long he's been there. He has no idea how long he's been in there. And then this whole shenanigans, you can see them falling for each other, but not... in a doughy, romantic way. You just see that they're really starting to appreciate each other's company, mm-hmm. and starting to realize that they have something unique, despite the fact, even including that they are stuck in a time loop together, but they are realizing that they are compatible.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, time loop shenanigans, an absolute delight of a scene.
Yeah, it's clearly one of the highlights of the movie. I was surprised in looking back just how there's not a lot of traditional montages in this film, per se. I do like that we get an 80s song over the montage a little bit. I forget what the song actually is, but the fact that we get an 80s song over the montage feels like a little bit of a callback to the films of yesteryear.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a few montages in this movie. Like, I cut... it's not quite a montage, but we get Niles recounting everybody that he's had sex with earlier on in the film, and that feels, like, not quite like a montage, but it's montage adjacent.
Yep.
And there's a couple little moments like that where we get some really quick cutaways. I think it's just the editing style, but it's very, very rapid fire.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very rapid fire. Real quick, before we get away from this particular montage, the dick tattoos as well. When she's tattooing a dick on him, and then he's doing the same to her, but she's just like, "And you're getting the balls right?"
But the funny thing is that he wanted something different.
Yeah, but she wanted a dick tattoo.
But she wanted a dick tattoo. And the jizz, it's in straight line.
Yeah, it's a dotted line. Yeah. Straight across.
My next scene is the next scene, camping.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Okay. Why don't you take this one?
This is where we start to get a little philosophical, and the characters really begin to see each other, and their chemistry is so good. Niles' analogy of the candy bar is actually really good, and I don't know why. Something about his explanation is just such great insight into his character and how he's feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, this emptiness, I have no interest in this emptiness, the way he waves his hand around what used to be a full candy bar and is now half eaten. Like, all that there is this. And he takes a bite and says, the next bite. Talking about how he likes to live in the moment, because there really only is the moment for him. There's no future, there's no past. It is only today. That is the way he has to live his life, and it's the way he does live his life. But there's still a little bit of humanity left in Sarah, and against Niles' will, she begins to tell him about herself, about her previous divorces,
mm-hmm.
or about her previous divorce, singular, rather, and her life before the time loop, and begins an earnest attempt to connect with him. Something about the fact that such a young character is written to have been a divorcee just really works for me here. I think it's the fact that like I said in the non-spoiler, where I kind of hinted at it, I view the time loop structure as being an analogy to marriage, just spending a massive amount of time with one person through time. So her saying, I knew it wouldn't work when I walked down the aisle. I knew it wouldn't work when I said yes, and I knew it wouldn't work when I moved to Austin for him, but I did it anyway. Now, knowing that, or not knowing that, would make me destined to repeat it. Yet here she is, essentially in a marriage again already, and allowing herself to be vulnerable. Something about that, impasse between those two facts, the fact that she was hurt and doesn't want to repeat it, but is already kind of back in the same thing, just works for me on some level. Yeah, this whole scene is good. And then, of course, I guess there is one other thing I can touch on here, because we're including them going into the tent,
yes,
as well. A great writing moment and a great Andy Samberg performance moment when she just says, like, let's get it over with. Let's just do it. And she hops on him and he almost stops her. He's like, Sarah, wait. And not knowing that they have had sex already, this just plays as Niles being really nervous about having sex with somebody who he actually really cares about. And I'm sure that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
But on the rewatch, knowing what we know, which is that he's lying to her and they've actually already had sex many times, this is his last moment. This is the last chance where he's able to make it right. Like, the first moment he should have told her that they had sex together was when she asked.
Yep.
I understand why he didn't, but he didn't do it. He didn't do the right thing. This is his second chance. This is the universe saying, like, hey, man, like if you're going to say something, you should really fucking say something right now. And he chickens out and he doesn't say it. And it on rewatch, it's really heartbreaking. You're like, oh, dude, just fucking say it. Like, we from the outside of their situation know that in time, if he told her before, she would be mad that she's been lied to. But the fact that he told her before sex would be salvageable.
Yes.
It would be salvageable. Not so much after the fact. It is a betrayal. Anyway, yes. Sorry, your thoughts on the camping scene?
No, Milioti is absolutely mind-blowingly good in this scene. Mind-blowing. She mm-hmm. is fucking incredible. She's already displayed some incredible comedic performance, comedic timing, great, great chemistry with Samberg, but it's here where she, in my opinion, takes a step above him. Her sharing the information about her failed marriage, she's really wanting to make a connection here, and he does not want to share. He is pushing back. Like, I don't want to talk about my past. And you can tell, he's like, I don't even want to learn about yours.
Yeah.
And he completely deflects away from it, and she is so disappointed. Because I love your marriage analogy now, because she's seeing this. She's like, I'm going to be with this man forever. I need to have a connection. And when he's unwilling, she is devastated by it. You can just see it in her face. She's like, oh. She wants to find reason within this whole thing. And he's just no longer interested in trying to figure out why this is happening or anything about that. He is exactly what he said. He's just interested in the next bite. He doesn't care about the future or the past, just the present. And it's really, really disappointing. And I can't remember what were they on?
Mushrooms.
Mushrooms. In my opinion, he's saved by the appearance of the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's, from my interpretation of the scene, she was becoming pretty disillusioned by his attitude in this. And their shared experience of seeing the dinosaurs kind of reconnects them, because that's when they start to hold hands.
Interesting. I actually didn't really read it the same way. I like that interpretation, and I like there. It's not. There's a lot of open space between the dialogue, especially at the very, like, right around the time the dinosaurs appear.
Mm-hmm.
I always took it as more when she asks him, or when she says at first, like, "Well, if you want to connect with somebody, you need to know their past. It matters. It does." At that point, she's, you know, she's trying to make a connection, and he is resisting. But I've always taken it that when she says, "What was your job? Like, what did you do?" Him hesitating and then being like, "I actually don't remember." I take that as the honest truth. I
definitely didn't.
Really?
Nope.
Oh man, I've always taken that as the honest truth. Maybe he has been trying to forget. I've kind of take it like he's been trying to forget for so long that now that he is trying to remember, he doesn't. He's lost that part of himself.
Awesome. I did not take it that
interesting.
Way. I took it as him just like, I want nothing to do with any type of real connection in here.
That's cool.
That's my interpretation of it. They end up having sex, and I never noticed, again, you watch this movie so many times and in a critical eye, there's a moment after they have sex, he's asleep and she's watching him. They're laying face to face, and she kind of like forces herself to stay awake to watch him. And right at this point, we still don't know why she doesn't want to go to sleep, but it's the very next scene that reveals it. And you can see she's holding on to this moment, this incredible night that she's had with this man that she appears to be falling for, knowing full well what she's going to wake up to. And that is my next scene, is the next day.
Oh yeah. Like from the moment she wakes up
from the moment she goes to sleep with him in the tent, the next scene is when she wakes up and it's revealed what she's waking up to. That's the next scene I have.
Devastating revelation.
Where it's revealed that Sarah has been sleeping with, or slept with Abe.
Yeah.
Now, we have no idea if it was a one-time thing or an affair. No idea. Doesn't make a difference. She has to wake up to the realization every day that she has fucked over her sister.
Mm-hmm.
She can't handle it. The emotional swing it goes from the night with Niles to waking up yet again in Abe's bed is too much for her, and she's having a crisis. And Niles is wanting to relish in the evening that they shared together, which meant something to him, but she's having none of it. And she sees a cop following them. Niles is now the one trying to connect, but she's lost in melancholy. She's lost in the moment and realization of what she's done. She wants him to resolve things with Roy, who she thinks is following them. So she pretends that Niles is kidnapping her. Niles playing along because who knows who's in there, but it is Roy. And then she hits him with the car.
She just clipped him.
And this is where she loses her mind.
Mm-hmm.
Taunting the other cop that shows up.
Suck my dick, officer bitch.
Dodges a taser shot.
Uh-huh.
And then what I do love is that as the cop's trying to maybe reload the taser after he's shot Niles, she's like, "I'm touching your bike. I'm touching your bike."
I wanted to include that too. Holy shit.
It's in here, I feel like, in this day, Sarah's become an anarchist.
Yeah, totally.
She just wants to tear it all down.
Mm-hmm.
And they're handcuffed. And then Niles reveals that they have slept together.
Yeah.
And that shockingly doesn't go well.
This whole scene, right from the top, the discovery that she has been fucking Abe or had fucked Abe is horrible. I totally understand why she hates waking up and cannot continue to wake up in there.
I think it's a one-time thing.
I've always read it as like a one-time thing.
Yeah, I think it's a one-time thing.
and Andy Samberg attempting to connect with her. The tables have turned in that sort of regard. I don't know if I have all that much to say about that section of it, but yes, when we get to Roy arriving and another little great mini reveal within all of this is the fact that the director is trying to make us think for a second, oh, it's not actually Roy. And he says, I'm sorry, officer, I thought you were somebody else. He's always listening to that gut feeling shitbird. Is a great moment, the reveal that it's actually Roy. But yeah, again, it's Kristen Milioti, and the way she's bouncing around taunting these cops is fucking hysterical. It's Niles who winds up getting the brunt of it. He winds up getting tased. The 1-2 punch of the lines, suck my dick, officer bitch, and I'm touching your bike, is comedy gold to me every time. What I did want to say about this section is that one of the things that resonated with me so much on this time around is the fact that both these characters are harboring secrets that they consider, that they know are very shameful.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Sarah has been having, or has had sex with Abe, and has maybe ruined her sister's marriage, maybe ruined her sister's life, betrayed her sister's trust, you know, the list goes on. And the fact that Niles has now fallen for this person that he has now dug himself too deep a hole to get out of. He doesn't know how to break the truth to her, and he really doesn't want to break the truth to her that they had actually had sex with each other. The fact that these two people are hiding things from each other is what makes this middle section of the movie so gut-wrenching. The fact that you're just like, man, if everybody had just been honest with each other from the beginning, like this could have all been good. What could have been?
Yep.
Yeah, and that just really got to me this time around. And yeah, I remember my first time watching this, and in the heat of the argument when they're arguing about nothing really matters, you know, if I had known I would have been locked in eternity with a pretentious sad boy, I never would have talked to you, and I certainly wouldn't have fucked you. And him just blurting out, who cares? We fucked like 1,000 times. And then there's this huge beat. There's this huge empty space after that line.
Yep.
What did you just say? Oh, man, the direction of that scene is so fucking good.
Yep.
And I remember watching that for the first time being like, oh, shit, that's a problem. That's really bad. Oh, no. Yeah, it's a great scene.
Awesome. What is your next scene?
I have meeting Roy in Irvine.
Me too.
Yeah.
Fire away.
Awesome. A lot to love about the scene as well. Andy Samberg desperate, screaming on the streets of Irvine for Roy. I can't remember if we know how he even found Roy's neighborhood.
He must have followed him some way, because he says, or you know what probably would happen was on Roy's origin story, he reveals it.
Yeah.
Because early in the movie, he says Roy is from Irvine.
Yeah, but like all I'm wondering is how he finds Roy specifically, like in that house or in that neighborhood in Irvine. Because my memory of it is that he's kind of doing the Ryan Gosling from La La Land, where he shows up to the neighborhood and just kind of makes a lot of noise until Roy emerges. But I don't know how he found himself to that neighborhood in Irvine, because Irvine is like a fairly large city as far as I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. I don't know. But I mean, not important. I was just sort of wondering out loud at any rate. But yeah, a couple great comedic moments in here. It's mostly a very dramatic scene, and J.K. Simmons gets to flex his chops. But when he introduces Niles to his wife and he says, this is an Andy Samberg, just completely offended. He goes, Niles? He can't believe that Roy forgot his name. Like, this man that he's been obsessed with for for an infinite amount of time or an indeterminate amount of time. Can't even remember his name. Niles. What are you talking about? That's so funny. But hearing Roy's perspective on being stuck in a time loop after having put Niles through so much and after having tortured him, having seen the perspective that he gains and his side of that philosophy is really nice, and the way that he's managed to find peace. He's still a little bit angry. He's still upset that he won't be able to watch his daughter grow up, and he won't be able to grow old with his wife.
Yep.
He feels like he's been robbed of a lot, and he certainly has been, but he finds the silver lining. He's, you know, look, like, my wife is in the prime of her womanhood. My children are beautiful, and it's a sunny, beautiful day in Irvine, California. Like, it's, there are worse places to spend eternity, and he kind of just makes the best of it. He accepts that this is just his life now, and he has to like it, so he just does.
Yep.
And he seems like he's doing okay, at least. It's a bit ironic that Niles hears this at this point in the movie, because he's kind of had this perspective for most of the movie. He hasn't necessarily been happy. I mean, at the beginning of the movie, he asks Misty to kill him. So he hasn't exactly been happy, but he's in a way accepted that this is just all there is. This is all there's ever going to be. But instead of trying to find happiness in it, he just accepts, oh, I'm just going to have to be miserable forever. And that's just going to have to be my life. But seeing Roy's perspective, like, hey, you can actually genuinely be happy in something like this, is, I don't think, something Niles had considered. And now that Sarah is gone, it's something that he can't achieve. The line delivery from J.K. Simmons, there's a little head shake. There's nothing worse than going through this shit alone. I don't think he just means a time loop. I think this is really just a broader statement about relationships and about life. This shit could just be life. There's nothing worse than going through life alone.
Yep.
And that is a piece of what Niles needs to hear in this moment, even though he doesn't quite know it just yet.
Awesome. That was my last scene.
Yeah. That was your final scene?
Yeah.
Oh, dude. Well, I mean, I cheated a little bit by combining a few scenes earlier, but I had to include the fucking speech. The speech at the end, the grammatical fucking nightmare.
Well, I know how much you love that.
So you intentionally omitted it?
Well, no, it just wasn't. I had five.
Oh, man. Yeah, this is one of my favorite conclusions to a movie, man.
I know it is.
This is such a great conclusion to this movie. We've talked about how Kristen Milioti has carried this movie from a comedic and a dramatic perspective, but this is a great Andy Samberg scene. This is a really, really good Andy Samberg scene of... He makes this dialogue sound so improvised. I think this must come from his SNL days.
Mm-hmm.
He just manages to make this sound so natural, the way he's seemingly improvising different punctuation to throw into the sentence to make it one sentence. When he says the word colon, when he's trying to think of other punctuation marks thrown, he goes, colon. Uh-huh. And he kind of gives her a little point, like, yeah, I know what a colon is. And then continues on. Yeah, so much about it is very enjoyable. And when he ends it with an emphatic period, I was like, yeah, that's a great way to conclude this, until Sarah points out, like, an emphatic period, it's an exclamation point. Like, it already exists. Yeah, so much about the scene to enjoy. It's heartwarming. And it is, it's funny, and it wraps up the themes of the movie that Niles just comes out and says it. He believes that life should be shared now. It's a lesson he has learned along the way. He has gone from somebody who has accepted misery. He has just accepted misery as his day-in, day-out reality forever. And he has learned to want more, and he has learned to accept somebody else into his life and hopefully make his life a little bit brighter. And it is a beautiful little character arc and a wonderful conclusion to it.
Awesome. What I enjoyed about the scene is that even after his speech, Sarah doesn't fall for it all. She's very hesitant. And
she's still hurt.
She's still very hurt. And she kind of reluctantly allows Niles to join her. Mm-hmm. And it's not until the moment right before death, and it's right before our possible death,
mm-hmm.
permanent death, where she decides, you know, she tells Niles that she loves him. And I think it's the fear and possibility that she might be wrong in her conclusions, and I think she wants to leave the world in a positive way instead of a negative way. Because after that hilarious run-on sentence, she, like I said, she does not, it's not your standard rom-com ending where she's like, oh, I fell for it. Like, mm-hmm. you won me back over. She's like, you fucked up pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
And you fucked up pretty bad, and you're kind of, like, I don't want to say, like, you're a piece of shit, but, like, you don't want to know me.
Mm-hmm.
It's only after I left that you missed me. And so she's very hesitant, and I really, really enjoyed that. And then they're about to go in and are about to blow themselves up in the hopes that that will kick them out of the time loop. And she, that's where she tells Niles that she loves him. They have the kiss, and then they blow up and stuff like that.
There's a great line, and a spoiler, it actually didn't make the cut on my favorite quotes because there was just so many good ones.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this line, it's partially in her delivery, where she's just like, I can get by just fine without you, you know, but this life could be a little less mundane with you in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is just such a great encapsulation of the movie and why I've been careful not to say this movie's about love, even though it obviously is. I view it as being more about companionship and mm-hmm. just having somebody, and how, like, even having somebody in a situation with you can be a source of comfort. Even, like, no matter even really who it is. Niles looks to Roy for comfort, for fuck's sake. Somebody who has actively tortured him because he has nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just about having a companion in a tough time. And that is an aspect of love. But Sarah says, you know, I can get by fine without you. But having you here might make me feel better. And that's really the bare minimum. And that's... that is part of the reason I think that scene in particular resonates with me.
Awesome. All right. What are you picking as your favorite scene?
God, there's so many fucking good ones. I actually don't know. God, you go first. I can't decide.
Okay. I really, really, this time around, I really wanted to give it to the camping scene because of how good Milioti is. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to go to the time loop shenanigans because it's so fun.
Yeah. I'm between currently... the grammatical nightmare and the time loop shenanigans, as you call it. The time loop shenanigans are so fucking funny. Fuck! I am going to go with the time loop shenanigans.
All right. all right, our next section, which is still a little bit of a work in progress, we're calling this Noms and Nods. So this is where we talk about other aspects of the film, mostly regards to acting performances or below the line credits and technical aspects of the film, or any type of nomination or award we would like to give this movie. Mm-hmm. And I'll start off. Chris Milioti,
mm-hmm.
fucking rules. And like I said earlier on when I talked about this movie, when I was watching it critically, her performance was even more elevated for me, and I'm... I'm going to slip her in Best Actress here.
Ahead of?
Because I only got to see 4 of the 5 nominees.
You did not see United States versus Billie Holiday?
That's correct.
So you didn't see Andra Day?
I'm going to kick out Andra Day.
Nice.
And I'm going to put in Kristen Milioti. She's so good in the camping trip scene, and she's fantastic at her final wedding speech right before she leaves.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely love her in this movie. So right there, I'm sliding her in Best Actress.
Yeah, I fully concur. She's the highlight of the film, both comedically and dramatically. I did not see the United States versus Billie Holiday. I also didn't see Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll happily substitute out Kristen Milioti for Andra Day, and while we're at it, I'll give Elizabeth Moss from The Invisible Man Viola Davis a spot. Nice.
Do you know? Okay, you know what? I'm going to say this right now. I'm going to say this right now because, and I'm not a fan of doing this, but a lot of times we're like, you have to take out somebody you have seen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I saw 4. So I'm actually out of the 4, I'm going to take out the winner. I'm going to take out Frances McDormand. While I think she was worthy of that win for Nomadland, in my opinion, of the four I saw, she's number four.
Mm-hmm.
I, like, Viola Davis and Ma Rainey is unreal. Vanessa Kirby and Carey Mulligan in Pieces of a Woman and Promising Young Woman, respectively, were mind-blowingly good for me. And I'm honestly sad that neither one of them got the Oscar for it. So I'll kick out, as per my rules sometimes where you have to kick out somebody you have seen, I'm going to kick out Frances to slip in this comedic performance.
I'm right there with you. I don't think I can give Kristen Milioti either Vanessa Kirby or Carey Mulligan's
spot. I can't take out those spots. Because
those performances were just spectacular.
I agree.
Frances McDormand, though, who also gave a great performance, is just not really a movie that resonated with me, not really a performance that resonated with me. It wasn't bad, it just wasn't for me.
I agree.
So Kristen Milioti, get a comedic performance in there, baby. Let's go.
Hell yeah. All right, what do you want next?
Yeah, sorry, I gotta navigate back to my notes. Yeah, you know
Damn
what?
It.
Just a curiosity, can we nominate J.K. Simmons for supporting actor? Can we just take a look at that real quick? I only saw two that year.
I've seen all of them.
So I only have Sacha Baron Cohen in The Trial of Chicago 7 and Paul Rocky for Sound of Metal, and I'm really upset that Paul Rocky did not win.
He didn't. There's no chance he was taking over. He was beating Daniel Kaluuya.
Oh, yeah. Was Daniel Kaluuya that good?
You have no idea. You have no idea.
Yeah. So I can't take out either of Sacha Baron Cohen or Paul Rocky. I really like Sacha Baron Cohen's performance in that film. I got to rewatch Trial of the Chicago 7. I gave it a 5, but I honestly haven't thought about it that much since, which is never a good sign. So I have to maybe revisit that at some point.
Okay, so we're going for best supporting. I can't put him in. I've seen all five.
Yeah,
I can't take out any of these.
I do love the performance of Roy. I love the comedic mixed with the dramatic. The scene of them getting high and drunk together for the first time, and like hiding in the bathtub, wearing the shits. That whole montage is really good. But
can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
This is horrible. As I just about to say, can I ask you a question? Mm. They're snorting whatever drug he took, but it's colored.
Yeah.
What drug would that be?
Like, is it kind of colored like yellow?
It looked greenish to me.
Greenish? I think, again, I'm not a big drug guy. I've never really done any hard drugs, so I can't really say. I think Molly, I think like MDMA has like a little bit of a yellowish kind of tinge to it, I think.
Okay, because when Roy says if he wanted to party, touch his nose, in my mind, that's just cocaine.
Yeah, I agree. I've always kind of taken it as cocaine. I've never really noticed the bag or the drugs that they're snorting. So I've always kind of taken it as cocaine. However, in my head, now that you mention it, I'm like, yeah, the drugs are, they're not white.
They're not white.
Yeah. So I don't really know.
All right. Whatever. I don't care. For those wondering why I'm so confused, I've never used any narcotic in my life. Illegal narcotic. Obviously, I've taken aspirin and those kind of those under narcotics.
Yeah.
I've never done anything that would have got me arrested at any point in my life history.
Whoa.
Yes.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So far, so good. Was that 46 years, 47 years? Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. You're turning 47 in December? 46? 45? 48? Goodness gracious.
Fucking hell.
You are one whole American old enough to drink, older than me.
Okay. I had this in my nomination list, but upon seeing the ones that's trying to get in there, I personally can't take any out, but I'm going to throw out the nomination anyways and we can discuss it. Best original screenplay.
Yeah, one that I had as well. Let's scroll down. So we got Promising Young Woman with the Wind, Judas and the Black Messiah, Minari, Sound of Metal, Trial of the Chicago 7. I have 4 of the 5. I haven't seen Minari still.
I got 5 of the 5.
Yeah.
And I can't take out any of them.
No.
They're too good of a movie.
Sorry, I have 3 of the 5 because I haven't seen Judas and the Black Messiah either. Okay. Yeah, I'm not taking out any of them, unfortunately.
I can't. I would love to. I was really happy when I saw that. I was like, oh, I'm gonna.
It is a really great screenplay. I do love the original take on the story. I love that we actually focus on them actively trying to get out of the time loop. I like a lot about the screenplay their connection, their character is all really good and really original, but it's just not to the level of the other ones.
Yeah. That's all I have for my noms and nods.
Did I have anything else? Not necessarily a nom, but definitely a nod to the cinematography being a little bit better than it has to be.
Oh,
Couple of really artistic shots in the movie. Like, I'm thinking of Andy Samberg on the diving board, his head framed at the very bottom of the screen with the whole pool surrounding him is a really beautiful shot. You have a great shot at one point of Kristen Milioti in the desert as she's running out trying to find the cave. She looks really tiny and isolated in this big, vast desert. There's a couple of really artistic shots. Nothing nomination worthy, but mm-hmm. I wanted to give it a nod that it was definitely better than called for.
Okay. Yeah. That's all I got.
Yeah, me too.
Cool. Favorite quotes. We're going to try something that we have tried before. We pulled audio clips from the movie itself for our favorite quotes. We're going to try to play them as kind of on air. And if I don't like the sound when I go to edit, I'm going to try and edit them in afterwards. But we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
So first up is Sam's 5 nominated best quotes.
Yes. This is my nomination number 1.
You gotta find your Irvine.
Number 2.
Even though I pretend not to be, I've realized that I am completely codependent. But I'm cool with it, because I think that life should be shared now. And I need you to survive.
Okay. That's your one sentence.
I need you to survive, comma! But it's so much more than that. Colin, I know you better than anyone knows you. And remember that night when we saw the dinosaurs? You said it yourself, in order to really know a person, you have to see the entire package, the good and the bad. And I've seen your package, and it is excellent, Sarah. Ampersand, you're my favorite person that I've ever met. And yes, I know that it's crazy odds that the person I like the most in my entire life would be someone I met while I was stuck in a time loop. But you know what else is crazy odds? Getting stuck in a time loop! ...
Ellipses.
Ellipses, thank you.
Called on ellipses.
Ellipses. Look, I hope that blowing ourselves up works, but it's really irrelevant to me, as long as I'm with you. And if it kills us, well then, I'd rather die with you then live in this world without you. Emphatic period.
That was a long one. Number 3.
What if we get sick of each other?
We're already sick of each other. It's the best.
And number 4.
Put your hands above your head!
Suck my dick, officer, bitch!
And number 5.
Try out, you son of a bitch! You ruined my plans.
Great. I didn't even tell you to put the "you ruined my plan" in there, and I thought about asking you to add it after the fact, which is great.
In all honesty, it was hard to cut out.
Yeah, no, it's great. I think it's important, but I just do love the way she says "foil." That was like a two syllable word. It's great.
Awesome. Yeah. So those are your 5.
I hope that came across. Yeah, that was my 5.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Yeah.
If they don't come across, then I'll edit them in so they do come across.
Nice.
All right, my 5 quotes. Here is my number 1.
You gotta find your Irvine.
I don't have an Irvine.
We all have an Irvine.
Little crossover there with yours. I went on a little bit longer. My number 2.
Pain matters. What we do to other people matters. Being a source of terror is not fun, okay? It's not fulfilling. I know this from experience. It doesn't matter that everything resets and people don't remember. We remember. We have to deal with the things that we do.
My number 3.
We are born lost. Then we're found. But we're all just lost, am I right?
Oh my God.
However, in the darkness comes light. Tala Ann Wilder and Abraham Eugene Trenchleafen, who do not look like siblings. You see, their optimism, their selflessness, it's in their blood. And Tala, there's something that a lot of people here don't know about you, but they should. I hope you don't mind. It's not just time and money that Tala has given to so many charitable causes. She has also donated of herself, bone marrow. That's right.
How did he know that?
She gave hers to her baby brother, Nico, saving his life. But now it's time for us to give to you. Here you are. Standing on the precipice of something so much bigger than anyone here. And it may be frightening and filled with doubt, but always remember, you are not alone. Everyone here is your family. We are your world, and we will cheer you on with delight in our eyes as you achieve your wildest dreams. So raise a glass. We may be born lost, but now you are found. Cheers.
Absolutely delightful. My number four.
You're a sick fuck, Roy!
Definitely gonna cut out the music. My number five.
Nothing worse than dying slowly in the ICU.
Those are our five quotes for nomination for best quote.
I think that went great.
I think that went all right. We'll see how it sounds.
Fuck, man, that speech really is so good. I can't believe I didn't have that in mind. That's so good.
Yeah, yeah.
Tala and Abe, who do not look like siblings, fucking kills me, man. It's so good.
Sam, your favorite quote.
Even if I had included that, I would rather die with you than live in this world without you. Emphatic period. That whole speech is a nice. Highlight of the film.
There's some really great quotes in here, and in fact, I really enjoyed the idea behind "You Gotta Find Your Irvine," mm-hmm. and I really do love "You're a Sick Fuck, Roy," but I gotta give it to Niles' first speech. Mm-hmm. The whole speech kind of sets up the movie and makes it thoroughly enjoyable.
For sure.
That's mine. All right. What is your weak link of the film?
My weak link, actually, we didn't talk about, but it's actually pretty easy. I've mentioned this to you off air, I think, before, and mm-hmm. in passing discussions of this film, even on air a little bit. I think the film is about 60 seconds too long. I think we should cut out the scene of them in the pool on November 10th.
You want them to end at the explosion?
Yes.
Interesting. Leave it open?
Leave it open because... Because the film is about Niles letting go of that control. He no longer even cares whether they wake up tomorrow, whether they spend the rest of their lives together, whether they die together. It's in that line, I would rather die with you than live without you, or whatever it is that he says. I would rather die with you than live in this world without you. I've had it right in front of me in bold as my favorite quote. I should have been able to say it. I think... giving us the closure that we know what happened defeats the purpose of the movie just a little bit. And it's always kind of bugged me.
Wow. Now, I'm not going to argue. I don't agree with that's the weak link of the film.
Hmm.
I really would have liked that ending. The majority of filmmakers wouldn't. The majority of filmgoers, film watchers would not.
Yes, and I think that's why that ending was not chosen as the ending.
100%.
I'm sure you probably have this in trivia, but the impression that I've gotten is kind of that the ending of the film was left up to the public. They created several endings and screened them to different people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the ending was kind of decided democratically, and in my mind, it shows. This is a very... people-pleasy ending.
Yes, it is.
It is not the most emotionally resonant in my mind, in my point of view.
So. Yeah. I didn't have a weak link. I honestly didn't. I like yours, though. All right, trivia. Andy Samberg admitted multiple endings were written and even shot. They held private friends and family screenings of the different versions to get opinions on which ending worked. Samberg jokes, all right, it might not be perfect, but everyone liked it.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel. It's just like a neat, tidy little bow tied up around it, but I didn't need that. Like, the point of the movie was had come across already.
We needed the mid-credit sequence, though.
Oh, fuck yeah, we did.
Yeah. For those of you wondering what it is, we didn't talk about it, but Sarah leaves a message for Roy on instructions on how to get out of the time loop. And the credits roll for a bit, and then we get a credit scene where Roy shows up at the wedding to talk to Niles, and Niles doesn't know who he is, mm-hmm. revealing that it worked. Uh-huh. That would have been the perfect ending.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And I guess you can't really get that if you don't have them escaping the time loop. So yes. That's entirely fair. Do you think Roy's crazy smile at the end of the movie, is he excited that Niles has been able to leave? Or is he excited at the prospect of returning the favor? At inviting Niles into the cave with him?
Oh, no. He's excited getting out.
You think so?
Yeah, him and... He says in Irvine mm-hmm. that he has forgiven Niles.
Yeah.
Like,
I had a lot of anger at you.
Yep, and he's let it go.
Yeah.
And, like, I would assume that if Niles had never showed up in Irvine, Roy would never see Niles again.
Yeah.
He had no intention of ever going to that wedding again.
I do understand that point of view, and it's probably the correct one. There has been a part of me that's always wondered, like, is Roy fallible enough to give in to that temptation? Like, he had a lot of anger. Is he really over it? Is this a test? But
do you want to get into some serious deep dive on this then?
Sure, if you got something for me.
Okay, so here it is. If his intention was to bring Niles into that cave, that's not the Niles that brought him in. He's getting revenge on somebody that didn't wrong him.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
Yeah.
That's totally fine.
Yep. He would be basically hurting an innocent person.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's my opinion.
Fair.
Yeah.
Totally fair. I'm not saying he'd be justified to do it.
Yeah.
Just wondering if he would.
It's just that it would carry no resonance for him.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting revenge on somebody that looks like the person that wronged you, not the person that wronged you.
That's fair.
So I don't think that was ever an intention.
That's totally fine.
Yep. This holds the record for the biggest sale of film at a Sundance Film Festival. It was sold for $17,500,069,
mm-hmm.
beating the previous record by 69 cents.
I have to imagine Andy Samberg had something to do with that.
100%. Sarah contacts a physicist named Clifford Johnson. Johnson is an actual scientist who worked on the movie, helping the filmmakers come up with the original premise for a time loop story.
Mm-hmm.
In discussing the movie, Andy Samberg has referenced Groundhog Day, Edge of Tomorrow, and Happy Death Day, and acknowledges that they're never able, that they'd never be able to fully differentiate themselves on the time loop front. Instead, they acted knowing that the audience would already be familiar with the specifics, which allowed them to avoid the usual setup time. Mm-hmm. That's why we get the beginning of the movie that we get.
Yes.
Yeah. They initially shot the scene with Niles running naked through the desert with Samberg's stunt double and then shot it with Andy Samberg himself, just in case it was too obviously not him. Quote, "but my butt was funnier," end quote.
Yeah.
Niles is drinking Akupara beer. In Sanskrit, Akupara means unlimited and unbounded. And in Hinduism, it's the name of a tortoise described as one who is without death. If you look close on that label, there's a graphic that kind of explains the mythology of the world and the earthquake. Director Max Barbico said recommending a Google of Akupara that will take you down a nice little wormhole that explains some of the metaphysics behind the movie. He credits production designer Jason Kizvarde with creating the look of the beer.
That is very cool, actually. I like the depth that they went to mm-hmm. on that.
In an interview, writer Andy Sierra is quoted as saying that Niles was stuck in the time loop for over 40 years.
I've felt like it's longer.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. But again, in my mind, I'm considering him... My reading of that scene with him and Kristen Milioti at the campfire is that he has genuinely forgotten himself. He has mm-hmm. genuinely forgotten his life before. And if that is the case, then it would have been longer. But if your reading of it is correct, that he's simply being coy, then yeah, 40 years is probably about right.
He probably could have forgotten as well because he doesn't care.
Yeah.
Right? He's given up on his past. But then that's counter programmed by the ending when he remembers he has a dog named Fred.
True. Well, never came up.
Yeah. When Darla asks the barman how much Niles has had to drink, he says he's still on his first. The drink has not yet been touched. In Back to the Future Part 3, another time travel film, the same exchange takes place between Marty, the barman, and Doc Brown until Doc triumphantly knocks it back, just as Niles does.
Oh, that's great. I didn't even realize that was a reference to it. That's fucking awesome. Didn't get to talk about this, but in the recounting of all of Niles' lovers, I don't know why this part specifically has resonated with me, but when he says that he had sex with Darla, and Sarah's reaction is, I bet that was great. And he goes, you would have bet right. For some reason, that's like a little funny and a little sweet to me. It's like, ah. It's kind of like there could have been like an easy low-hanging fruit joke about like sex with an old lady there, but they're like, I bet she was great. Like, oh, yeah, she was great.
One thing I noticed, I think this was the first time I watched the movie with subtitles.
Mm.
And the initial, I could have used it when we talked about the scene, but I just want to throw this in because I fucking laughed pretty hard because I never noticed it before. But when Niles takes Sarah to see Trevor and Misty cheating on him, when they cut just away and you're watching the cheating happen and then you kind of focus both on them back outside the window talking, in the background, Misty says, say something in Australian to me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good line.
That made me laugh so hard. I couldn't find any casting what ifs for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get to the closing credits. Silly question, Sam. Would you watch this movie again?
No, I think five's enough. I think all I'm right. Good now.
I'm sitting at six, I think I said.
Okay, maybe just one more. Okay, maybe just one more.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, six.
This would be a great time loop movie, by which I mean, like, stick me in a time loop and I have to watch one movie every day forever. Like, I could probably do this one.
I could do this one. I could do Booksmart.
Booksmart would be good.
I could do Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm. Back to the Future, I feel like, would be your answer.
Yeah.
I don't know what would be my answer. I'd have to think about this. This would be a candidate, though.
Yeah. Would you recommend this movie to friends?
I would. Absolutely, I would. And I have. I have many times. And I've recommended for them to go in blind, as you did to me.
I have as well. Yeah. Case in point.
I have brought them into the cave, as it were.
Yes. MVP of the film?
Christian Milioti.
Same.
Easy pick. Respect to Andy Samberg. He's very good in the movie, too. But she just brings an extra level.
Recommend a good double feature with the film.
I mean, a bunch of them were just mentioned in that trivia piece. I really did try to come up with one that wasn't a time loop movie, but for me, I chose Edge of Tomorrow. Great time loop movie. It's a you and I have talked about this, but like every time loop movie now is destined to be Groundhog Day, but blank.
Yes.
So I don't know what you would call this one. Groundhog Day with two people, maybe. Maybe Groundhog Day at a wedding. For me, Edge of Tomorrow is it's a Groundhog Day but an action movie. Yep. Groundhog Day in space.
Yep.
Or, you know, whatever it is that you want to say. Great action movie with Tom Cruise.
Great action.
Really good. And Emily Blunt as well.
I went with the obvious one. I went with Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Groundhog.
I figured you probably would. I was like, I'll switch it up.
Both
would be good. Honestly, triple feature. Call it a triple feature.
Totally. I tried to think of I was like you. I tried to think of a non-time loop movie that would be similar to this kind of thing, and I just couldn't think of something.
This is a pretty singular movie.
Yeah, and so I just decided to go with the obvious one. As always, what order?
I'm going Edge of Tomorrow first, Palm Springs last.
Interesting.
I'm ending on the light note, and I'm ending on the movie I like better.
My initial reaction would be to flip your answer,
uh-huh.
But I'm going to agree with you, and I'm not going to spoil it, but I think the reason to have Palm Springs second is I love Edge of Tomorrow, but the ending is shit.
Yeah, and he's not very good.
The big climactic ending is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is the weak point of the film.
Almost five.
Mm-hmm. The ending is what prevents it from being a five.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go Palm Springs, then Groundhog Day. I'm gonna end with a delightful Bill Murray. Oh, what will be this film's legacy?
Best that I had, I'm going to say what I wrote first, and that is one of the defining films of the time loop genre. So, like, this is forever going to be enshrined with Groundhog Day, Edge of Tomorrow, whatever films come hereafter. It's one of the defining time loop movies. That's one. I wonder, and maybe you can answer this, I wonder if this will have a reputation as, oh, this is a film that came out during the pandemic. I wonder if there's anything to that. Especially because it feels a little bit pandemic-y to me. I mean, it's about two people forced to spend a lot of time together, which is a thing that many people experienced during the pandemic as well.
I don't know if you were aware of this, but during the pandemic, Groundhog Day was a very popular film.
I think I was maybe aware of that, but have since forgotten it. But that makes sense.
Because we were stuck in the same day over and over again. Well, the majority of people were. I wasn't. Life basically didn't change for me because of my job.
Yeah. Like, I think you can look back on particular eras. Like, if you think of, like, World War II, I think of Casablanca, for instance. When we look back to, like, the roughly two-year stretch, call it beginning of 2020 to end of 2021, I wonder if this will be viewed as one of the defining films from that snippet of human history.
I think you're
am I shooting too high? Am I overestimating? Yes. I'm overestimating the impact of this film.
Yes, because of our social circles,
yeah,
love and admiration for this film. I don't think it's that big outside of our social circle.
Yeah, it's too bad.
I wish it was that. I don't think this film will have a legacy.
Oh, it's too bad.
I don't think it'll be considered a defining time loop movie. I think this will be another time loop movie.
No.
I do.
Oh, it's too bad.
I do. I hope I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this movie has a legacy. I hope I'm proven wrong, but that's my feeling.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Because I don't see many people talking about this movie. What are we, 3 years later? Outside of our social circle. I don't hear any podcast referencing it. I don't hear anybody harking back to how great Palm Springs was outside of the people we know.
Yeah. I get, like, I'm not being sarcastic when I said this. I think the podcast circuit is, like, especially, like, podcasts that actually get people listening to them, unlike us. I think that is actually a good indication of what people are watching. Not only because, you know, they are people who watch movies, but also because they recommend movies to people. Mm-hmm. And if they talk about them, people watch them. 618,000 watched on Letterboxd is what we're at as of right now. November 2nd.
Mm.
It's not nothing, but it's also not a ton.
Yeah. All right. Did you learn anything from this movie?
I stole another last-minute cut from my favorite quote nominations. That is a... life can be a little less mundane with someone you love in it. A little variation. But that to me feels like one of the many things to learn from this film. Life can be a little less mundane with someone you love in it.
I'm not going to have an answer for this because I just realized I forgot to do this part.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. So I'll just steal yours.
Sure.
Okay. Sam, your final thoughts on Palm Springs.
I was so happy to do this film. As you could probably gather, both you listening to this podcast and you, Manny, sitting in the chair in front of me, this is one that only increases in value to me as we watch it more and more. My previous watch to this film was about 2.5 months ago. I watched it this summer, and I loved it then, and I love it now, and I will probably love it on the next time that I watch it. This is in danger of becoming one of my top, if not the top, comfort movie for me. Just like throw it on in the background.
Really?
Yeah, it's...
Ooh, I like that.
It's a great, great little film. The performance of Kristen Milioti, both comedically and dramatically, is excellent. We get another sort of two-layer performance from Andy Samberg as well, and from J.K. Simmons. All of them doing good work on both sides of the coin, comedy and drama. More good scenes packed into an hour and a half than you could ever possibly hope for. The fact that I had to make cuts to my 5-scene limit in an hour and a half movie was frankly spectacular. I rarely have that problem. Sometimes I'll have a 6th one that I'll have to decide between. I had 8. I couldn't decide. I had to cut so many. Want to give a brief shout out to a quote I didn't have room for, but I can't let us close out this episode without saying at least once. You know, one time I smoked a bunch of crystal and wound up in Equatorial Guinea. It was a huge waste of time. They detained me as soon as I got off the plane. Andy Samberg's delivery of that line is phenomenal. So, yeah, a well-constructed and well-written movie with one excellent performance and two pretty darn good performances in it. An original take on the time loop movie, and what a take it is. I will revisit this movie time and time again, probably for the rest of my life.
Yeah, this is going to be a movie that I will be watching fairly regularly. I agree. Actually, I love your idea of it as a comfort movie. I've actually actively avoided watching this movie because we were reviewing it, and because I wanted to kind of come in with some fresh eyes and some stuff. So now that the review's over, I could see myself putting this on a fairly regular basis. While that being the case, I don't think this will ever kind of seriously threaten my top 20 of all time. But it's a movie that will be some very nice comfort food for me. It is hilarious. It is touching. And like my co-host showed me, it is a really great meditation on companionship, which will only enhance my viewing of this movie the next time I watch it.
I will only add that I, previous to my watch in August, it had been a year since I had seen this film, so I watched it in May of 2022, May 15th, 2022, and then
May
August.
May 15th?
May 15th.
2 days after I did.
Oh, weird. I probably saw you watch it in the group chat, and I went, fuck, I gotta watch that.
I bet you did.
And then August of 2023, August 17th, 2023, I watched it as well. And now, again, 2.5 months later. When I watched it in August, I was actually recommending it to friends. I was visiting some friends in Victoria, and we were just at the end of a long day. We were looking for something to unwind with, and Emma and I both went, have you guys ever seen Palm Springs? And we recommended it to them. They really liked it.
This will be a movie that will be very fun for me to recommend for people when they come over here to watch a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be kind of one of the movies I'm like, oh, have you seen Palm Springs? They're like, no, but that's the one we're watching.
Yeah.
To watch this with somebody that hadn't watched it before will be enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. And you, I know that you won't, but you can't tell them even the plot.
No, I won't.
Just like, hey, romantic dramedy, or not even a dramedy, romantic comedy with dramatic elements. Andy Samberg, Christian
Milioti. I wouldn't even go dramatic. I'll just say it's a rom-com.
Yeah, rom-com.
It's a rom-com that's not for, it's a rom-com, but it's not for, it's not made for women.
Yeah. Like, not made only for women.
It's not made only for women. Yeah. All right, Sammy, time to give this thing a rating. What you giving this bad boy?
It was never in danger of being anything but. It's easy five.
Yeah, it's a five for me as well. That means it is included in the Sam Pantheon. Do you know how many we're at now?
What is that, like 35 or something?
Four.
34?
34.
Yes.
Yeah, 34. Okay. Sam, what we got going on next week?
Next week, episode 273. It is Remembrance Day, and we're continuing with our tradition of doing a war movie for Remembrance Day. All Quiet on the Western Front, the 2022 edition. Very much looking forward to revisiting that. It was a very tough watch the first time, and I'm looking forward to retreading it a little
Me
bit.
Me too, and it is almost exactly 1 year ago that I watched it, October 30th, 2022.
Oh. Wonder if I can find that too. You know what I'm looking forward to? In my mind, even though I remember liking this aspect of the film, I remember feeling that the win for best original score was a little controversial in my mind.
Really?
Not controversial like in the Oscar circle, but I just have so much love for Justin Hurwitz's Babylon score.
Oh, fair.
That I remember just being like, yeah, sure, happy that, like, any other year I would have been happy that it won, but the Babylon score is just so near and dear to me.
I can understand that kind of thing, but I this score is fucking phenomenal.
Oh yeah, and like effective. It's yes. The Babylon score is one that I can listen to on its own, whereas the All Quiet on the Western Front one is not one that I can. I mean, you can put it on, but it's less enjoyable on its own. November 5th, 2022. So
I feel this is another one I told you to watch.
It was, at this point, I think it was already garnering some pretty big Oscar buzz. Yeah, I think this was one, though, where I don't know if it was like specifically like, Sam, you need to watch this movie, or if it was just, I was going to watch it anyway. I honestly can't remember.
I feel like I told you to watch it.
Maybe.
Wouldn't be surprising.
It would not surprise me at all. What episode did we record that week last year? Was it Bugsy, or was it the previous one?
So if I watched this on October 30th, it would have had to have been the following week. So it would have been, I would have watched this going into us recording Dunkirk.
We probably talked about it in the Dunkirk episode. Maybe I'll go back and re-listen.
Possibly.
Anyway, not that it really matters.
I kind of want to pull up the Dunkirk episode.
That'll take too long.
Actually, it would be actually really quick, but I won't do it. please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. If you give us a 5-star rating and a positive review, it does increase the profile of our podcast, allows more people to find us, which we would greatly appreciate. You could also give us a rating on Spotify. Also on Spotify, you can jump on there, answer our weekly question. We didn't have anybody answer our question from this week, so I couldn't answer. We couldn't put it on the air, but whatever. You can follow us on Instagram and Threads at Sam_Manny_movie. You can email us at sammannymoviepodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Letterboxd at Manny42 and Sam Reimer, respectively. For the Samuel Emmanuel Movie Podcast, I'm Manny Emmanuel.
You gotta find your Irvine. I'm Sam Reimer.
Adios.
So now what do we do?
Well, I should probably go pick up my dog.
You have a dog?
Yeah, Fred.
You have a dog named Fred?
I do.
You've never mentioned this.
Never came up.
Where is he?
With a neighbor.
What kind of dog is he?
He's one of them shaggy dogs.
He's one of them shaggy dogs.
Hey, what the fuck are you doing in our pool?
I guess I come back November 10th.
I went downtown to see my lady. I stood there waiting, it'll be alright when the morning comes. Now I'm up in the air with the rain in my hair. I got nowhere to go, I can go anywhere. It'll be alright when the morning comes. Just in passing, I'm not asking that you be anyone but you. When you come home, try to come home alone.
Hey, Shitbird. I got the message from your girlfriend last night. That is a pretty crazy theory. You really think it could work?
I'm sorry. Do I know you? I'm Niles.
Hi.
Hi.
No way. Daisy, I'd like a lots of alcohol, please.
Nice to meet you.